The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio. It is 7:30 this Thursday morning, I want to say. It's Thursday morning, yes.
Certainly.
Wow, this is one of those weeks that's actually going in quite fast, right?
95% sure it's Thursday.
Me too. We had a Wednesday pre-recorded Joe Brawley. That's how I know it's Thursday. He's all over the newspapers today. You're going to hear the full interview from Joe with us a little bit later on. A lot of talking points. He wants a shorter GAA season, which I think got lost in the whole, you're a hypocrite because you're working for AIR and you said you'd never work for AIR. And he's like, well, I changed my mind. And everyone's like, okay, that's a good answer.
We accept people who change their mind, right?
I do. I do, right? Because you reach a certain stage of your life and you're like, I'm not sure I agree with everything I said when I was 25, for example. Mm. There's a lot of stuff you're saying right now, Owen, that you're going to regret, I would say, in about 15 minutes.
I thought you were going to go 15 years there. 15 minutes, 100%. I'll regret probably this very next sentence.
I think it's a very unique situation as well, where what made the RTE Sunday game panel worth watching over the last 15 years? What was it?
Anarchy.
Where did that come from?
Joe Brawley.
Right. And now that it's gone, it's going to be very interesting to see what they do, because he's making the point that there was a WhatsApp group where they were getting fed stats constantly and being essentially guided on what to say, and that there was no sense of creativity or no sense of freedom in how the conversation was going to be scripted. Mm. He says the line that we've been running for the last 24 hours or so is, you need a newsreader, not me. And it's like, well, there's a little bit of that to it, isn't there? For all that I would disagree with a lot of what Eamon Dunphy said, and his viewpoint on a lot of things became willfully, it just seemed dumb. Like his opinion of Cristiano Ronaldo was clearly just something that he stuck to far longer than he should have. But at least there was entertainment in that. And there was somebody else there to do the analysis. There was a mix. If it's just all going to be this happened, this happened, this happened, and then this happened, and this happened, and this happened, who's going to watch that? Mm. What's the point of that?
Yeah, like I think these panels, it's going to become match of the day.
What do people want? I think that's a good question to ask. What do you want from your half-time and full-time analysis? And I'm not talking about match of the day, because with match of the day, right, it's people who haven't seen the games, here's the highlights and the goals.
I'm talking about obviously the analysis.
Yeah, but that's what it is. But the analysis is bland. The analysis is very bland. There's no crack to that.
No.
It's a
Gary Lineker's puns, however, are excellent.
It's a British, very British institution. It has roast beef on Sunday, mm-hmm. and it goes to service and it sings its carols.
And
it's British.
And you sit there and you laugh at the follically challenged jokes being made about Danny Murphy and Alan Shearer.
That's like, classic. Classic of the genre. If that's what we're going to, is that what we want? I don't want that.
Well, the thing is, is it what you want or is it what you're given? Like, people will tune in their droves for Match of the Day because, as you say, it's got the best collection of highlights every week. That's changing now because of the digital age, and people don't necessarily need to go and blandness.
Exactly. It was the only one, and there's obviously going to be a residual audience for that. But, like, a good question to ask this morning, what do you want from your analysis? Do you want no wildness, no reflection of what people are actually talking about, and just pre-programmed, well, we're going to do the defensive structure, we're going to do the attacking structure, we're going to focus a bit on the referee, but not too much, because he's an amateur, and that's it.
Also, as well, something that needs to be realised is that it's not an either-or when you ask yourself the question, do I want my facts presented in a good way, based on statistics, based on information that perhaps the ordinary punter wouldn't have access to, or do I want information? Like, it doesn't necessarily need to be one or the other. There can be a happy medium, and like off air, you made the valid point of Tony Romo there, which when you're listening to him, you're not just getting the unbelievable insight that a former quarterback brings on a predictive level. You're also getting an unbelievable passion and entertainment from what he's talking about. He used an amazing Rocky reference last Sunday night after the Chiefs went 21-0 down. And I was like, this is hilarious. This is brilliant work from this commentator who also informs us and educates us with the information at his disposal. So you don't need to be one or the other.
Well, Tony Romo is such a unicorn that his current deal is $4 million a year. He's currently being offered $12 million a year. That's what we're talking about. That's the level of person you're talking. If there's a Tony Romo within Irish sports, I would argue that it was Brawley. And
I wouldn't go that far.
And they've got rid of him. Well, who knows? I mean, maybe there could have been a way of getting him to do a bit of the tactical analysis too. Who knows? But like, is there anybody else in that panel you can think is going to be Tony Romo?
He's definitely the most. He's definitely the biggest unicorn that RTE have had, because even if you read his columns on a Sunday, you tend to glean a bit of his football nous, and that's kind of been left behind in the television age, and seeing the kind of short soundbites that you get at halftime on a Sunday game, or in particular if he was ever on a highlight show, that's even shorter soundbites. Like, but it's interesting, you think about the way that they've moved now. So they've made a decision to get rid of Joe Brawley, which suggests to me that they're making a decision to focus more on analytics, to focus more on statistics, to focus more on educating the public. And yet, we've come off the back of a season where we've had one of the most bizarre outbursts that the Sunday game has ever seen. And it came in the Hurling Championship with that Dunlough Cusack rant about the Brits. If that's what the Sunday game is becoming, then like Joe Brawley would fit in perfectly into the let's rant about everything sort of nature. But this is a new statistical era, and we still have this stuff. So I don't know, is there kind of a lack of clarity about the identity of what the programme wants to be?
Bear in mind, Tony Romo obviously does the analysis. He's a co-commentator, so he has that. There is the kinetic energy of the match actually unfolding right in front of you. And the studio analysis, the only other studio analysis of somebody who might be along those lines that of the, I'm going to give you the X's and O's, is Gary Neville. But again, who on the RTE Gaelic football panel is Gary Neville?
Mm.
Who? Give me names here, Owen, I'm asking you.
Well, I'm just trying to think, when they walk over to the other side of the studio and use the big screen, I suppose Kieran Whelan would...
That's Sky you're talking about.
They have a big screen on RTE as well.
Oh, do they?
It's on the evening show only.
Yeah, so okay, again. See,
they walk over to the other side of the studio. We never actually see the walk. They usually just kind of come back from ads into there, so at least it's time efficient. Tomás O'Shea, I would say, is an excellent pundit and can deliver on both fronts. Tomás O'Shea and Kieran Whelan really are the two kind of stand-up pundits, and they're excellent. They're brilliant, brilliant pundits, and it's not to say that the other assets that they have aren't great. It's just that you already had an amazing asset who's been there for so long.
It is, though. It is. There's a blandness to the rest of it. There's an incipient blandness that kind of coagulates around everything and squeezes the... I'm flicking here. I'm going on Twitter to find out what people are saying.
They still will have Spillan, who will be prone to an explosion, but the explosions won't be as violent since his buddy's gone.
7:38 this morning here on OTB AM. Here's what's coming up. Daniel Harris going to join us at 7:45 to talk about Manchester United last night, going through against Wolves and giving Ole Gunnar Solskjaer another stay of execution. It looks like it's a stay of execution all the way to the end of the season at this point, right? Although Mauricio Pochettino apparently is like just kicking his heels, sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what's going to happen. Top five stories of the day. And then from 10 past 8 this morning, we're going to bring you our studio interview with this man.
Like, I'm like a fish and water when it comes to the telly. I love the telly.
Yeah.
Like Ron Burgundy.
Yeah. Ireland's answer. The GAA's answer to Ron Burgundy. Owen has been binge-watching the Aaron Hernandez documentary on Netflix. For those of you who might have listened to the podcast series from the Boston Globe over the last 18 months or so, this is a nice companion piece worth digging
yes.
into.
Companion piece is probably the best way to put it.
Virtual Insanity from John Duggan. How to win some money from the golf this weekend on the PGA Tour. Sports news with Tom Malone, and then Deal or No Deal coming your way at 9:15 this morning here on OTB AM with Phil Egan. Right, it is 7:40, time for the papers.
OTB AM.
The Irish Times leads with state willing to pay $5 million a year to save FAI. So this is a triple byline story from Jack Horgan-Jones, Emmett Malone and Joe Brennan. The government is prepared to pay up to $5 million per year as part of an emerging deal to safeguard the future of Irish football and the FAI. Sources confirmed the state was prepared to restore its grant support of $2.7 million and augment it up to a level of $5 million as part of a wider agreement being discussed by the government, the FAI's lenders and UEFA. So it looks like we're inching towards a deal. The mood seems to have changed with the appointment of the independent directors. And away we go. It looks like the FAI is going to be saved, and hopefully the jobs will be saved, which is the single most important thing at this stage. Mata strikes to inflict knockout blow on Wolves. Picture of Juan Mata scoring last night. And then the picture of the most important relationship in Irish rugby at the moment. Andy Farrell And Johnny Sexton, Farrell squad hints at more fluid selection in future.
The Irish Examiner this morning, shining a light. Irish international Claire Shine opens up on her journey out of the darkness. Steve Mackey's on a two-page interview with her on her mental health struggles. Fresh start, Sexton named captain as Farrell talks up merits of first Ireland squad, while Special Juan is the headline on the Manchester United result last night. His chip keeps United in the FA Cup hunt. Boxing clever, the lure of TV sees Brawley face up to hypocrite tag and cutting edge. Cadogan says Cork must add ferocity to armoury.
The back page headline here is Brawley, I'm a hypocrite. Joe Brawley's admitted that he is a hypocrite for taking up an offer from Air Sport to work in their coverage for the Allianz Football League. We'll bring you that later on. FAI rescue is in sight. That's Mark McCadden's story there. And Man United 1, Wolves 0. Juan in, one out. The one out is obviously Marcus Rashford, who went down injured last night. And yeah, I don't know. Sorry. Ireland obviously beat the West Indies in the T20. Windies blown away. Paul Sterling receives his Player of the Match award after Ireland's shock T20 win over the West Indies in St George's last night. So a big, big night for Irish cricket. They love the Caribbean. We always do very well over in the Caribbean. Mm. Maybe we could play all our games over there.
It's like that lotto ad. Just set up Ireland somewhere in the Caribbean, in the Caribbean somewhere. It seems to do pretty well for us. 2011, obviously, that big shock in Bangalore. Back page of... Sorry, that's not in the Caribbean. Back page of the Times is Archer injury puts Wood in line for recall. That's Jofra Archer being ruled out of today's third test against South Africa. Cavendish's Olympic blow, meanwhile. His dream of an Olympic gold medal, Mark Cavendish, that is, appears to have been crushed after he was controversially left out of the final UCI track cycling World Cup event in Canada this month. Kipchoge in new Nike row. So Eliud Kipchoge facing fresh criticism after claiming his running shoes he used to run in his sub-2-hour marathon effort only gave him the same advantage as a Formula One driver with the best engine. And the gloves are on, this little headline at the top here. Serena's been sparring with Mike Tyson in a bid for Grand Slam number 24.
Who?
Mike Tyson.
Who's been sparring with him?
Serena Williams.
Oh, right. All right. Irish Daily Mirror, back page. Juan and only. The one matter ones. I mean, come on, lads, come on. Try and do something different here. Matt is the hero, but United suffer scare with Rashford injury, so we'll see what's happening. Free to air, don't make me laugh. Brawley, maybe I'm a hypocrite, but I'd already lost argument, is the Mirror headline. And Paul stays with Dubs. Paul Clark is staying on as a selector as part of Desi Farrell's backroom team. With Mick Galvin already on board again, Clark, another star of the 95 All-Ireland winning team, will help maintain continuity, along with logistics man Shane O'Hanlon. Brian Cullen will also stay with the squad. So that... backroom team is rounding out nicely at this stage, and Moyes banks on Barkley. David Moyes has targeted an audacious loan bid for Chelsea and England midfielder Ross Barkley. The West Ham boss wants a reunion with the schemer he nurtured at Everton. Was Barkley not playing at the moment, though? He is, isn't he? He started last week, anyway.
He's had a troublesome season so far, though, so I wouldn't be surprised to see him leave Chelsea this year. Back page of The Guardian is back in the fast lane. Wood to make timely test return after Archer drops out, and Mata's touch of class sends United through. Solskjaer gains revenge for last season's FA Cup defeat against Wolves to reach the fourth round.
Here's Johnny Sexton to lead Ireland into Six Nations battle. Sterling starts for Ireland in a thrilling T20 triumph over the West Indies, and Rashford injury mars United win. So, and then they have the headline there, Brawley, I lost the fight on pay-per-view GA.
The Daily Telegraph this morning leads with the headline, The Juan Show. Mata's superb second-half strike puts United into FA Cup fourth round. World's best, Stokes is named ICC Player of the Year after incredible 12 months. Wales are ready to unleash a Gloucester Wonder Boy. And Aluko quits, former England striker, calls time on her career.
The Irish Sun, the back page there. Juan up, one down. That's the same one again. Mata winner at rash back injury fear. Fern feels so at home. Getson Fernandes. Is it Hargy or Softy? Getson Fernandes?
Getson.
Mourinho completed his first signing as Spurs boss with the arrival of Fernandes, who's only 21. Jesus, he's a name that we've heard about for multi years at this stage. Sex appealed. Get what they're doing there? Johnny Sexton. Johnny Sexton hopes to return to full training next week to ensure he does not have to sit out his first game after being named Ireland captain. And Africa Cup Reds alert. Liverpool could lose Mo Salah, Sadio Mane and Naby Keita for 6 weeks next season after the Africa Cup of Nations was moved back to the winter. And that would be something that would soften the cough of Liverpool next season.
It certainly would. Racing Post this morning. BHA to investigate after runaway Wolverhampton winner stuns rivals, which is an interesting one by Jack Haynes and Andrew King in the Racing Post. Back page of the Racing Post focuses on the golf Toot Tango. Informed duo ready to shine on the La Quinta dance floors.
So this is interesting. Back page of the Irish Independent this morning. FAI consider appointing another interim CEO. The new FAI hierarchy mulling over the idea of bringing in an interim CEO. Talk continue over attempts to put together a rescue plan to save the troubled association. So there would be an interim CEO, and then that CEO would hand over to the long-term CEO, because it's going to take them so long to actually appoint a long-term CEO. And then RTE silent over Brawley criticism is Frank Roach's story here. RTE has opted to maintain a veil of silence after some stinging criticism from its former star pundit Joe Brawley, who has joined the Air Sport team. Brawley was scathing of changes in the Sunday game editorial policies since Declan McBennett became head of sport. An RTE spokesperson last night issued a brief no comment when contacted for a response to the claims.
The Herald this morning leads with some quotes from Joe Brawley as well. Dubs to hit Sam for six. Another year of blue rain before Kerry strike, he says. Randolph, meanwhile, delighted to return to West Ham. And Sexton is a new Irish captain as Leinster trio step up. The other GA story there, also from the air launch yesterday. Gainey hits out at Mark. Kind of, I'm not sure do you feel sorry for the players who were involved in the launch yesterday.
Not getting any of their, no bang for their buck.
Whatsoever. It's brought Brawley front and centre.
Well, there you go. It's almost like he's, a very high profile character who you would do anything that you possibly could to keep within your organisation because, bang for your buck.
You certainly got bang for your buck with Joe Brawley. You might have had to work hard to get bang for your buck, and it might have been a little bit annoying every so often, but if you have him, you keep him.
Yeah. 7:47 here this morning. Let's move to our first story this morning. Man United are across all the back pages after their 1-0 win last night against Wolves in the Cup. Daniel Harris joins us. Daniel, good morning to you. How you doing?
Yeah, good. You're right.
We keep doing these stories where it's like, oh my God, it's reached the point now where surely something's going to happen and Solskjaer has to go. And then there's like two good results. And like, another stay of execution. We're in this kind of weird interregnum where for every two bad results, there's three good ones.
Maybe. I think that ultimately, and I was thinking about this yesterday, if you gave any manager in the league his squad, where would United be? And I don't think they'd be very much higher in the league. They might have a few more points, but we are only talking about a few more points. Ultimately, I would say, and I keep saying this, that he made one significant error, I think, which was spending the Harry Maguire money on Harry Maguire and not on the midfield. But otherwise, the team are doing roughly what you'd expect them to do, and you can still see them improving, and they've beaten most of the good teams in the league also this season. So I wouldn't say to me, like, I don't feel like he's particularly close to the sack, and I would definitely like to see him get a go at managing with a midfield before he gets sacked.
So you're essentially saying that he's as good as any other manager in the Premier League?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying other managers might have gone about getting the points in a different way. I'm just saying that if you gave Pep Guardiola a midfield of Fred, Matic and Mata, you would not see particularly coherent football, I don't think. And I don't think that is a particularly controversial thing to say. Of course, he's not as brilliant a coach of elite players as Pep Guardiola. And he doesn't have what Jurgen Klopp has either. But then, if you're comparing their careers, Jurgen Klopp was at Mainz for a bit, and Solskjaer is roughly at that period in his own career. So, inexperienced manager, you've got to give them an opportunity.
Well, exactly, except that it's very rare that you get an opportunity at a club this size. I just think that coaching matters to the point where even with this squad, those managers will be doing significantly better because they're much further down the line in terms of understanding the shortcomings of players and being able to game plan around them and maybe not put them in the team, find somebody else to do it. If he needed to put Fernandinho back centre-back to make up for the fact that his centre-backs aren't very good, Pep Guardiola has the ability to coach a central midfielder to play centre-back at a significantly high level to be able to survive through that. I do feel that, like, if Manchester United had a world-class coach, they'd be much further down the line right now, irrespective of what squad or otherwise they had.
I'm not sure. I mean, because you gave the example of Fernandinho playing centre-back. To me, like, I don't think that's necessarily been a masterstroke. Fernandinho has played well at centre-back. He's been excellent at centre-back. However, they've missed him in the midfield and they've missed the ability to keep the ball away from the defence, which is what has characterised all of Pep Guardiola's teams. And then if you talk about the coaching, I think you're talking about probably different styles of manager. And whether Ole Solskjaer should be hiring an elite coach is a good question, and probably he should, because Michael Carrick and Kieran McKenna might not be that. But Solskjaer is not himself doing, I don't think, that much of the coaching. He's more following the Ferguson model of the manager has words with particular players, before particular occasions where he thinks it will be suitable, and he picks the team. But if we're talking about the coaching, looking at the Manchester United squad, has Marcus Rashford improved this season? Has Brandon Williams improved this season? Is Aaron Wan-Bissaka improving going forward? And those are just three questions, and the answer to me to all of them is yes. And it's going to sound like I'm saying that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is the best possible manager that Manchester United should have. I'm not saying that, and I'm not saying anything like it. What I'm saying is that he's hamstrung by the lack of a midfield, and I don't particularly think that any other manager would have United with loads more league points than they currently have. They're still in all the cups. So what actually are we talking about here? What? So let's say they're going to appoint Maurizio Pochettino. Maurizio Pochettino is an excellent manager. I don't personally think that we've seen enough to tell us that Maurizio Pochettino is someone who, if he's available, you must go and get that man. And Barcelona didn't think that either, which is why they went and got a very different man. So I don't think that it's as clear that there's this outstanding candidate for the job who you know would definitely turn up and immediately revolutionise everything and do a better job. And you could look at Maurizio Pochettino and say he completely turned the club around at Tottenham. But when it came to making that final step, he proved himself to be incapable. He lost the league to Leicester, and then he lost the league to Chelsea when he had the best striker in the league, probably the best defence in the league as well. And he still managed to lose the big games. So Maurizio Pochettino is not the second coming of Alex Ferguson or Jock Stein or Bill Shankly. He's not shown that he is any of those things. So, I mean, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't either, but the job that he's doing, to me, is not so bad that you would necessarily replace one with the other, but I agree that it's a fair conversation to be having. It's just not one that I feel I have a strong answer about at this point.
Okay. Is it just that coaching ticket, and that includes the two guys you talked about there as well, because, you know, there are stages of the career where they might end up being, Michael Carrick might end up being one of the world's great football coaches, but again, he's very, very early on in his evolution. You said you'd like to see him have a midfield before you make your judgment up on, or your final decision on whether or not Solskjaer is going to make it. It looks like he might get the opportunity to make it to summer, and then it's whether or not the board panic, or whether or not they, in the eyes of some Man United fans, make the right decision and get rid of Solskjaer at that point. So it looks like the stay of execution has at least lasted until the summer, and he will be the one who's preparing the transfer strategy for the summer.
I mean, for me, with the other managers that have come subsequent to Fergie, I wanted rid of them when I ran out of hope, when it was clear that it wasn't going anywhere. And I guess with David Moyes, that was before he was appointed, because it was just so obvious that it wasn't going to go anywhere. But then with Van Gaal and Mourinho, I was happy to let them have a bit more time when it looked like there was a possibility of things still improving. And it was only once things looked like they weren't going to improve that you felt, OK, these guys need to go. Whereas with Solskjaer, you can see that things are still improving. United have started whacking the rubbish teams at home. They're still struggling away from home. They've been beating some of the better teams. They've mentally look a little bit stronger now, so that although Manchester City stepped off in the second half of the League Cup game, and we can't pretend that they didn't, everything was there. All the excuses were there for United to collapse, and they didn't, and they managed to bring it back, and at least they now go to the second leg still in the tie. They're still in the Europa League. They're within 5 points of Chelsea, and we keep hearing about what a wonderful job Frank Lampard is doing. Well, why aren't Chelsea further ahead than United then, if Solskjaer is doing such a terrible job, given that Lampard has senior players who have done a lot more in the game than Solskjaer's senior players have? He has N'Golo Kante, for example. He has Cesar Azpilicueta, players that have been instrumental in teams that have won trophies, and yet they're only 5 points ahead of United. So in terms of the players that he's going to buy in the summer, I thought he did a fair job last summer. Wan-Bissaka, I mean, I don't feel that that required a lot of skill, spotting him as the best right-back that United could buy. Daniel James was an excellent buy and hopefully will improve. And Maguire, I have my doubts about, but Solskjaer must know that the midfield requires some work. He played in front of the greatest midfield in English football history. So what he really needs to do is he needs to be given the money and he needs to pick the right players. And who those players are is an interesting one, just because the quantity of players in world football who can improve Manchester United's midfield is so vast and the choice is so cornucopic that picking the right ones on the one hand should be easy because any port in a storm, but on the other hand, the choice is so varied that it could be a hard thing to do.
You forgot to mention the most important strand to your argument, which is that Manchester City put out a full team against Manchester United last week and tried their best.
That didn't come over very well when you said that, I must say. But in the end, like, I mean, I hated that when David Moyes was saying it, but in the end, he was hanged by results, not by talking rubbish. And I think it was the point that Solskjaer was making was it a fair one. He just shows bad words in which to make it. What he was saying was, we absolutely gubbed this lot the last time we played them, and ordinarily they would rest players in this game, but they knew they couldn't afford to do it against us. That is a better lot. That's the same sentiment, just delivered in a more confident, self-confident way. But I mean, I subsequently saw Gary Lineker on Twitter saying that, actually it's not really true because he left out Jesus and he left out Aguero. But the reason he left them out was because of the way United beat City at City, and he wanted to play 17 midfield players to keep the ball away from United. And how United respond to that in the second leg, I've not a clue. I don't really think, with the players that they've got, that they've got an answer to that tactic. So if I was Guardiola, I'd do exactly the same again. But in a sense, Solskjaer's point was fair. He just chose quite weak words in which to make what I think was a fair point.
Will Bruno Fernandes excite the Manchester United fans when it comes to their midfield worries?
I don't know, because I don't believe that very many Manchester United fans have seen Bruno Fernandes play more than about three times. Much as it is unfashionable to say, I don't have an opinion on that, or I'm not sure. I think that as many people have seen Bruno Fernandes play regularly as had seen Nicolas Pepe play for Lille before he signed for Arsenal. So what I would say about Bruno Fernandes is, personally, I am suspicious of him. His numbers are phenomenal. And given those numbers, the fact that he's still in Portugal at the age of 24 makes me slightly suspicious. Mm. And the second thing about Bruno Fernandes that makes me suspicious is his numbers are so good in terms of just goals and assists that if he's also a player who can help you control the game, and he's able to translate that to play in a better league and not in the best team in that league, then we're talking about one of the greatest players in the world. And how can you have a free run at one of the greatest players in the world at their peak? I don't get it. So I'm suspicious about Bruno Fernandes for those reasons. However, what I have seen of him is he can obviously shoot from distance, and he won't get the space to do that in England that he's been afforded in Portugal. But he's quick, he's aggressive, he's got a good touch. All these things are things that United need. As I said, what my concern would be is not really looking at his statistics, but just wondering if he's got the quality to translate what he's done in Portugal to a high level. I'm sure he won't score as many goals, but if he could score even half as many goals or two-thirds as many goals, then you're talking about a player. And the thing that United lack two things really, is against the good teams, they lack the ability to control the game, to keep the ball away from their defence. And is he able to do that? And against the less good teams, they lack the ability to create opportunities against a blanket defence, against a low block, I believe we have to call it these days. I would say he seems to me, based on the two or three times I've seen him and the YouTube highlights packages I've seen, that as long as the music that we're listening to is absolutely rubbish, he looks like he has the vision to pick holes in defences. I'm not sure whether he will help United dominate a game against a good team, but I'm absolutely certain that he's better than Jesse Lingard and Juan Mata combined. So that would be a start.
How do Manchester United play football at the moment? What is the shape of Solskjaer's ideal starting 11?
The ideal starting 11 is probably, well, the only real doubt is who plays on the right wing, but at the moment it's Daniel James. It probably will eventually be Mason Greenwood. And in midfield, his first 11 is probably McTominay, Pogba, and an attacker, whether it's Lingard or Mata or Pereira.
Or Fernandes. That's the role for Fernandes.
Yeah, if you sign Bruno Fernandes, it will be him. McTominay, Pogba, Fernandes starting to look like some kind of midfield, because you've got McTominay, who's your box-to-box player, Pogba, who can do all the jobs depending on what he feels like doing, but he could be the numbers. Again, I feel like we have to call them by their numbers these days, the number six, the number eight, or the number 10. And then you've got Fernandez, whose main job would be to prompt around the box. So you've got a good balance there. The problem, obviously, is that no one knows what's going to happen with Pogba, but he's not going to be back imminently. We know that. And McTominay is also not going to be back imminently either. But they've actually found all right workarounds, given that they've been without those players for quite a lot of the season. And we knew before the season, if either of those two got injured, United was shafted. Mm. They've actually found workarounds in that Fred has improved. That's another one that we're not allowed to chalk up to the coaching staff. But Fred has improved. Pereira has also improved. And these are not United standard players, or at least they're not players of the standard that United are trying to get to. We know that. But they've been doing enough to protect the defence enough, not well enough, but enough, and to provide enough ammunition for the strikers to get goals at the moment. And United did have a big goal-scoring problem earlier in the season. They don't really have that anymore. So that at some level is testament to the way that the strikers have improved, perhaps the way that they've been told where to run, they've been developing a better understanding of how to play with each other, and the slight improvement. Fred's improved massively over the course of the season. As I said, he's still not that standard of player that you would want, but he's a lot better than he was 5 months ago, yeah. And that's significant.
All right, Daniel, we got to go. Thanks a million for joining us this morning.
No worries, I'll see you again.
That's Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts on the 1-0 win for Manchester United against Wolves last night, which sees them through to the next round of the FA Cup. A reminder, next Wednesday, the 22nd of January, it's our Super Bowl preview show. It's Off the Ball's American football show, The Snap. We're going to be on the road in association with the Aer Lingus College Football Classic as we build up to one of the biggest events in the sporting calendar, Super Bowl 54. We're going to be live from the NFL room at the Woolshed in Dublin for a preview panel. It's going to be myself, Ronan Mullen, Cian Fahey, and we're going to be joined by none other than the great Mike Carlson. We'll also have some other special guests to look ahead to the finale of the NFL season. It's in association with the Aer Lingus College Football Classic, Navy versus Notre Dame at the Aviva Stadium on the 29th of August. Check out collegefootballireland.com for game tickets and more. And remember, the show will be over 18s. Tickets for the panel are now available from offtheball.com/events. It's a small enough venue and the tickets are going pretty quick for this. So if you want to come along to the show, meet Mike, get your photograph taken, whatever, then offtheball.com/events. Plenty coming up in the next hour. We're going to review the new Aaron Hernandez documentary. Owen watched the whole thing last night and has a piece up already on offtheball.com. We'll also bring you our exclusive studio interview with Joe Brawley back after these. OTB
AM. Have you seen a change? Have you seen the maturity there you mentioned at the start when he has been captain, that he approaches games slightly differently now?
Yeah, but I'm not saying he's the finished article as well. I think, you know, if that's in your personality, you know, you're always, sometimes you don't have to scratch too far below the surface to bring it out. And I think it's something that he has to be very aware of, particularly as captain, as being the focal point and being someone to try and sway a referee into a certain way of thinking. I think he's got to be very comfortable or very clear and concise with the way he goes and approaches referees, and to not come across as antagonistic as maybe he's done so in the past. And that's definitely something that I'm sure Andy Farrell will have spoken to him about, and something that he'll have thought about, that will be vital to, you know, picking up where Rory Best left off, because I think that was one of the real hallmarks of his captaincy, that he was pretty unflappable irrespective of what sort of decision was thrown at him, good or bad, that he was able to work referees well and get them on side. And I think he had a great relationship with them. And I think in those 50-50 calls, or as you know, a game is swinging one way or a momentum is going in a particular direction, I think when you have a good relationship with the referee, it definitely helps your side when, you know, when things are going the wrong direction.
A little bit of captaincy advice for Johnny Sexton from Brian O'Driscoll there on last night's show. You can get that full podcast on offtheball.com/podcasts or the Go Loud app. Our top five stories today. We know a fair bit more about Andy Farrell's Ireland, some left field selections, particularly in the hooker spot, and it's maybe more about the players who aren't in it than the players who are in it at the moment for the Six Nations. We'll talk about that. The very latest from the FAI suggests that we're getting towards a deal fairly quickly as things stand. Obviously, the politicians want to get out and start canvassing. Joe Brawley all over the papers today and in studio with us yesterday, talking about his new role at Air Sport and the Damascene conversion from somebody who would never work for Air to now all of a sudden for the league campaign. Going to do four games for them. The new Aaron Hernandez documentary is out on Netflix. I haven't seen it, but Owen has. Three episodes?
Three episodes.
Binge watched yesterday for us. already has a piece up on offtheball.com. You can get your teeth into that. And Troy Parrott's future, not playing any football at the moment. He's kind of in that limbo between the under 23 team and the senior team and not actually getting the game time that perhaps he needs. Maybe he doesn't. Stephen Lumby was on yesterday saying, he's 17. Relax, everybody, relax. But maybe at 17, if he gets a little bit of game time, he can play for us.
Yeah, when you have someone like Jason Lumby on at the age of 2021 saying, he's a young boy, leave him. You know that he is a very, very young kid.
Let's talk a little bit about Ireland. You're a rugby man now, Owen, having ventured out to the World Cup. There were some surprises even for you, I would suggest, in the squad that was finalised yesterday.
The big surprise for me is Rhys Ruddock not being in the squad. I think you're a pretty big Rhys Ruddock fan. I think he's done very well for Ireland and for Leinster over the past couple of seasons. I think he's possibly, you can make the argument, he's in better form than some of the back rows that have been included in the squad. Like you have Niall Scannell, who missed out as well, who I'd also have a lot of time for. So that's a bit of a surprise. Like the kind of, you question how big the transition is going to be from the disaster against New Zealand in the World Cup. And perhaps it's not actually that much of a departure.
Yeah.
Like you have Rob Kearney and Rory Best, who aren't going to be involved anymore, you suspect. You have the two names that I've already mentioned. And then you have like a couple of injuries as well. Obviously, Joey Carberry won't be involved. But so that's kind of opened the door for a few new names to come in. Like the Leinster boys in the back row, Doris and Deegan, they unquestionably are going to get their opportunity.
Over the course of the five games, you would hope so. Can we just stick the squad up there again? Because I'll actually just read it for people who are kind of half paid attention to it yesterday. The top line story was obviously the fact that Johnny Sexton is going to be the captain for us. So if we can just stick the squad back up again. And I'll read through it for anybody who's listening to us on OTB Sports Radio. So the forwards, funnily enough, that when they released it, they actually released the squad by provinces, which was really interesting because it's a complete turnaround. And this one has the forwards, backs and then development players. So we now know exactly who's going to be going in. Robert Balakoon, Harry Byrne, Will Connors and Ryan Baird are in the training sessions. They're getting access to the first team. Again, all being told about this is wonderful for us to be able to have a conversation about it and to know exactly what they're thinking about. So the forwards, in alphabetical order, Deegan, Doris, Delan, Furlong, Healy, Dave Heffernan, no caps, but Hooker from Connacht, who obviously has been very impressive so far this season and has caught the attention of the new coaching ticket. Ian Henderson, Rob Herring, who is first or second choice because the next name after him is Ronan Kelleher, Dave Kilcoyne, Jack McGrath back, Jack O'Donoghue, great, we want to see him get a fair bit of game time as well, Peter O'Mahony, Tom O'Toole, Andrew Porter, James Ryan, CJ Stander, Devon Toner and Josh van der Fleer. So Tom O'Toole, interesting name in there. Jack O'Donoghue in there completely on merit. Rob Herring will be looking at the fact that he is fully fit at the moment, I think, certainly.
It's bad how
Ronan Kelleher not fully fit.
There's just been a complete clear out in the hooker position in the space of 1 year. Like the top three would have been Best, Scannell, Sean Cronin this time 12 months ago. Now you've got three new faces.
Yeah, and so the backs there also pretty interesting. Will Addison straight in. You're like, okay, alphabetical order, I'm going to be first or not there at all. So Will Addison is in. Bundiaki, Billy Burns. So if Sexton isn't fit, it's Billy Burns and Ross Byrne fighting it out there. Andrew Conway, John Cooney, Keith Earls, Chris Farrell, Robbie Henshaw, Dave Kearney, who I think might get a fair bit of game time because he has been very, very good. He's played every game. That helps. Jordan Larmer, Luke McGrath, Conor Murray, Gary Ringrose, Sexton and Stockdale. So there was a bit of speculation that maybe Jameson Gibson Park would be in, but Luke McGrath gets the nod. And it was Stuart McCluskey was the name that yesterday on this show was picked in his starting 15 by Stephen Ferris, who didn't even make the squad.
No, but I guess when you look at Ireland's midfield, it's not necessarily an area that's let Ireland down badly in recent times. You can pick out different parts of the squad and you'd be like, they've been disappointing. The midfield really hasn't. Those four names in Ringrose, Henshaw, Farrell and Aki have all been pretty good and they haven't had absolute clangers. Henshaw struggled to get back from his injury in the World Cup. But
now he's back.
Yeah, now he's back.
There was brilliant points made yesterday by Stephen Ferris about how the players who have played have been given an opportunity and so therefore all of the evidence that we have is based on the players who are playing. And the players who are playing have not been largely subject to the player management. So there's this weird scenario with these couple of months where it's not the current Irish coaching tickets team. So, for example, Rhys Ruddock might have had his minutes managed. But if Rhys Ruddock hadn't had his minutes managed, because he was part of the Ireland squad, he might have had enough game time to get into the Ireland squad. Yeah. So he's got punished. There's like this weird, like, you're not playing because you're part of the World Cup squad.
Well, that's it. The reason why Max Deegan has got so much game time is because Reece Ruddock was in Japan.
Like, and so he shoots forward ahead of him. I mean, maybe you don't get that back. You know, there are a bunch of other scenarios where players have played themselves in. So he was making the point about Cooney. Like, after the Munster game, Munster get hammered. Everybody goes, Munster being pushed backwards. He's like, yeah, but if you look at the very basics that Conor Murray was doing, they were all excellent. Mm. His box kicking was superior, was the point that Stephen Ferris made yesterday to John Cooney's. So it's being able for the Irish management to be able to read exactly what's going on, to know exactly the minutes that are being played, and to be getting the statistical data about, are they hitting their career peaks and number of rooks hit, all that kind of stuff that, like, we don't get access to that information that goes into making up a squad like this. And then lo and behold, certain players have put their hands up and might be playing away. Alton Delan is somebody I'm dying to see back in an Ireland shirt, in a starting Ireland shirt. There's a bite to Alton Delan. There's an aggression to Alton Delan that I think would be brilliant to see. And who knows, maybe he is the natural partner for James Ryan. Like, that's a possibility.
In the long run, possibly.
Right now, he's not old. Oh, sorry, he's not young. He's like
mid-20s, I suppose.
Like, let's have a little bit of mix and match and see, and put a bit of pressure on Henderson, and maybe put a bit of pressure on James Ryan as well, just to go, look, it's been seamless for you so far. Everybody says you're the next captain. You bet your place down in the team. You become the world-class player that we think you're going to become. Mm. Don't settle for being the best Irish player. You've got to get up there. You've got to get into the Lions team.
Yeah.
How are you going to do that? Here's a little bit of pressure for you. Let's see.
You've got to be comparing yourself at Mauro Itoje and Brodie or Talik. That's the level that James Ryan should be aspiring to. It's an interesting theory. Like, I'd like to see it in action. It's definitely not going to be boring seeing Alton Delan playing beside James Ryan. But I think the Henderson-Ryan partnership at the moment just looks a little bit out of reach, a tiny bit. Now, one bad game, a little
Henderson
bit.
Is that good in the World Cup that he's safe?
Like, I'm not saying it's completely indestructible, but I would definitely say they're worth a start in the Scotland game. They've definitely earned at least that. We're going to move on to the FAI. A couple of interesting stories this morning. One that I just see in front of me here is that Dan McDonald's one that FAI are considering appointing another interim CEO. Stopgap option on the agenda as talks over cash solution are set to continue for the rest of the month. So you've got stories then during the rounds in all the other papers around the financial solution to the FAI, the possibility of getting £5 million a year from the government that's been floated, and generally an increased sense of optimism yet again as a result of what we're hearing from yesterday. So SIP2 have been quoted in the newspapers to say that the job losses are still a huge risk in the FAI, but perhaps they're not going to be as bad as first feared. And there is just kind of a mood music that is starting to shift a little bit. Now, we still had words from Shane Ross 2 days ago that a more democratic process needs to be installed in the FAI, and things aren't perfect in his view when it comes to the FAI's governance. So there are still things to be worked out, but things seem to be moving in the right direction. As I say, the hierarchy of the FAI, according to Dan this morning, mulling over the idea of bringing in an interim CEO, because hiring a full-time CEO will be a top priority. But
just buys them a bit of time, makes everybody exactly. Calm down. It's like somebody you can work with the board. Remember, the board are volunteers. They have day jobs. So all of the stuff that they're doing at the moment is on top of what their day job is. You need somebody who's in running it with nothing else to do, whose sole job is to meet what the board say they have to do, to meet the requirements of the government, to meet the requirements of UEFA, to make sure that there's a commercial plan, there's a marketing plan, that there's a ticketing plan in place, that, you know, that's the logistics around the senior international team are all being managed properly. And I'm sure all that stuff is actually happening anyway. It's fairly seamless. But at the same time, you can't take your eyes off that while you're busy dealing with perpetual crisis. So that all seems to make sense.
Yeah, like the other thing that's just important to note here is that Stephen McGuinness, who, like, we've spoken to on the show numerous times over the last few weeks, he's been mentioning the League of Ireland aspect and all of this, and he says that the government have assured us that UEFA told them that the League of Ireland has to be at the absolute centre of Irish football and whatever happens from here. And there seems to be a general sense of security around the safeguarding of the League of Ireland at the very least. Because, like, things did not look good at the end of December. Like, there was a bit of panic and there was a bit of misinformation.
Exactly. There was loose lips. And when the ministerial, then the two of them are uncertain about what actually happens, despite the fact that's their job to know this, when that happens, panic sets in. But I think everybody who had an understanding of how the league has worked in the past and could work had a fair understanding that like that didn't make any sense, that the league was always going to survive. The league is probably nuclear proof at this point, having come through everything that it's come through over the years. And you know, I think the PFAI were obviously on top of that from the get-go, as were the Premier League teams, who kind of had meetings and had come together. And like, that's the genesis of a breakaway right there. That this little bit of crisis is the genesis of a breakaway. And here's the thing: maybe they don't need to break away if the organisation is run properly from this point forward. But at the same time, maybe they do.
It'll be very interesting. Like, that's, I know you can't, beggars can't be choosers sometimes. You can't necessarily see how the FAI is going to be formed and how it's going to be run over the next couple of years. But there might be an argument for staying within the tent at this point if the FAI is going to come through this in a better place than it previously has been. I say if, it's a big if. Like, it's still a massive few months. These couple of appointments, like the final independent director appointment, still to be done. Like, why was only three appointments made rather than four? Probably couldn't get somebody for the fourth job in that time frame. And then obviously appointing another interim CEO suggests that there's probably a lack of full-time candidates available, or the appointment can't be made so soon. So still a lot of questions, but at least things are looking a bit more positive.
All right, let's move on. It is 18 minutes past eight this morning here on OTBAM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. We're here with you every morning, by the way. If you're just tuning in for the very first time, you're very welcome. And thanks very much for seeking us out. We've got a great podcast network where every day you can actually just get this podcast and it's timestamped. So if you're only into football, if you're only into rugby, you can download that and flick forward to it on whatever podcast app you're using. The best one for us is obviously Go Loud, but you can get us on Spotify, you can get us on iTunes or Pocket Casts or whatever it is that you're using. And again, offtheball.com. All of our content goes up there, as does all of our video on YouTube as well. Now, time for our third story of the morning, and it's the OTBAM Joe Brawley studio interview. Joe has joined Air Sport as a pundit for their 2020 Allianz League coverage, and yesterday afternoon he joined us in studio for about 45 minutes. Here's part one. Okay, this is going to be good. Air Sport have announced the details of its 2020 Allianz League's coverage. Over 7 weekends, Air Sport will broadcast a total of 15 football and hurling games. Coverage kicks off on Saturday, the 25th of January, with the home of Saturday Night Live GA action broadcasting 3 matches across its channels. Joe Brawley is with us, hence the slightly delayed start there. You were talking about Logan Paul and who was the other guy?
KSI.
Is that what it was? Were you watching that?
No. There was a fella who interviewed me earlier. He's got his own YouTube channel. I'd said to him, you know, he's got a great opportunity now to fight naked in the octagon.
Yeah.
You know, for, I must say, they get those boys like 15 million.
No, they made loads.
Coins or something.
Yeah.
You get yourself in shape, Gilroy.
Well, it's on its way. We're swimming a mile and we're doing a triathlon this summer. You know, the midlife crisis is coming to all of us. Is the midlife crisis what's happening to you now that you're on pay TV? Is that the, how are you standing in this one?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, obviously I was hurt by what happened with RT, and because it was very shocking, really, in its way. And you know, to be told a few days after the drawn All-Ireland final, which I thought was boisterous and created great debates. And, you know, I mean, I was in Radio Kerry the following night. The fella rang me and he says, would you come on to stand over your outrageous comments? I said, oh, absolutely. And you can imagine the hours fun there was in Radio Kerry, after which the producer rang me and he says, I want to apologise for some of the intemperate remarks of our listeners. But, I mean, where do you get that? You know, it's our recreation, our fun, our joy, you know. And anyway, to be told 2 days later, oh, you know, you made an outrageous and unprofessional comment to Pat Spillane at 11 minutes past 3 in the drawn game, which I had actually forgotten. You said to him, would you stop pulling my arm? I said, like, really? This is where we are. You know, micromanagement. I mean, the new head of sport who'd come in was clearly gunning for me from the outset. Now, because I'm in the freelance world and you can sort of rise above and you're not used to that, I felt like I can handle this, you know. You just rise above it. And, you know, everything became banality, you know, statistical heavy. And he brought a statistician in, and I mean, this statistician, who's a nice fellow, but I mean, he was glorified. And very quickly, things became much more controlled and scripted, and don't say that and don't say this. And I mean, before the All-Ireland final, for example, we got a script. This is what you'll be dealing with, and this is what your video analysis. I said, you need a newsreader. You don't need me. And I thought, you know, all of this stuff about, you know, because people sort of said, oh, you know, but me and Joanka, I thought that was all a bit of fun, you know. I mean, this is all good. The audience loves this, you know. I mean, if it's one thing I have, it's a very strong connection with audience, because I've been doing it for a long time. Mm. And I love the telly. And I'm a fan, you know, and I'm very good with strangers. So it was just a perfect fit for me. And, you know, when you're sitting in the studio and you're getting your phone buzzing, I mean, you're like the politician being controlled by the spin doctor. This is the head of sport. I mean, I'd never seen the previous head of sport. You get the odd text saying that was great fun, great telly, blah, blah. If you and figures are great, that's it. You know, they let you at it. The only time I met them, really, apart from some friendly phone calls, would be contract renegotiations, which were always dead easy. And then to be in this situation where you're getting text after text after text, while you're waiting to go live at half time, and it's a statistics group, it's a WhatsApp group that he had set up for the analysts, which he dominated. You know, it was like, I mean, I can show you some of the screenshots, like, which I took just to, you know, so I didn't have to pinch myself, was that true? And you get, like, floods of this stuff, read this out. Kerry's productivity rating in the first half was 23 or 1.2. I mean, and statistics have their place, but this choreographing of the programme so that, you know, and I was warned early on by a producer, he said, look, he's gunning for you. He rang me, a pal of mine, he said, look, he's gunning for you. And but still, when it came, I knew that I was being treated differently, but still, when it came,
because you knew it was final at that stage, or did you think there was...
I know he said to me, you know, he said, look, you know, and as a result, your contract's not being reviewed. And I said, what? And I said, we've had a great final. We've had so much fun, you know. And then he said, oh, we'll keep it all confidential. And I said, look, I'd appreciate that. It's going to take me a while to recover from this, you know, because it's a very public humiliation as well, you know, because I've been a part of that for... It's been a big part of my life for 20 years, you know, and what a blast I had. What fun. You know, all through the years, and that public conversation, you know, I go to 30, 40 GAA clubs a year, and you're welcomed with open arms, you know. And, you know, like, people get upset because they love the game, but it's panto villain stuff, you know. And so anyway, he said, we'll keep it entirely confidential. And then the next day in the Mirror, there was a headline saying, oh, Joe Bully's RT career was over. So, like, it's betrayed as well that way, you know. And then I got a text, you know, I suppose you'll be wanting a token of appreciation. Fuck me, like.
What, a text?
Like, a text from the head of sport, something like, you know, I suppose you'll be wanting a token of appreciation. Like.
What, like, a gold watch kind of thing? Is that, was that, was that, was that invitation,
clock,
or was it?
Clock.
Okay, because your time's up. Now look,
so then I just thought, look, you know, I mean, this is...
To just for the sake of covering ourselves here, Declan McBennett is not here at the moment, and I'm sure there's another side to the story.
Well,
and
I'm surprised you haven't brought him here.
We'd like to invite him on at some point in the future to give his side of the story, just to even things up.
Sure.
But look, I think balance is overrated in most of these conversations generally. It's just that...
Well, it's one of the... You know, it causes inertia because you say, well, you can't say that because the entire population of Kerry isn't in the studio. You know, and don't forget, this is us talking about Gaelic football. I mean, David Goff texted me whenever, obviously, the headlines came out then after the Mirror had done that, and he texted me and he said, I should have given that free out. You know, which about sets the bar right. We're fighting over a yellow card here.
Yeah.
You know, I think that as soon as David gave the penalty, you know, and I disagree with him about that penalty, it was, for me, it was never a penalty. And there was a feeling immediately when you're live and it's spontaneous, you know, you're thinking, well, Jesus, the Kerry boys have got to him, you know, the stuff about...
All the week,
He shouldn't be refereeing the game. And then when the big call started to flow thereafter, by halftime, I mean, that was the big talking point. You know, the game went on to be stupendously exciting, of course, and extremely tense. But I mean, if you had said to me coming out of that studio afterwards,
you're getting sacked for this.
Yeah, because I mean, at the end of the game, I don't know if you remember when it was still live, I gave Pat a hug and said, you must be so proud of your nephew. I just want to say, you must be very proud as a family. You know, the way he performed today for 10 minutes was pure Spillane. And Pat was very emotional about that, and he thanked me afterwards as well. Like, me and Pat are like an old married couple. You know, that don't particularly like each other. No, that's not true. We do. Great affection for Pat, and we've always had that. So I told Pat, and he just couldn't believe it, you know. And but there you go. I mean, you can't control this narrative. He's the head of sport, and that's the way he does business, and that's fine, you know.
So that's the end of your RTE career at that point. Is there? Is that why you're going to air? Does that counter?
Well, I mean, I love the public conversation. I've always been used to it, and like, you know, I've got the newspaper thing with the Independent. It's great, and I have great freedom there, and it's very grown up. You know, it keeps me hooked in. And it's important too, because I do a lot of evangelizing. I mean, my real satisfaction in life is the altruistic side of my life, you know, the communitarianism, you know. So I'll be at, I said to you, 30, 40 clubs a year, you know, do organ donation events regularly in communities, maybe 15, 20 a year. You meet people, you know, you hear the stories, it deepens your life, you know, you increase your empathy for the world around you. And the immediacy of TV is very good from that perspective, you know, because, you know, people are less and less reading newspapers.
So you think that TV gives you the platform to do that?
Well, I know that it does. I mean, I could say something. I mean, I could, like, I remember the time, the Sean Calvin thing. David Hickey rang me that evening. He said I was in the bar in Killarney and there was a standing ovation afterwards. Now, you can't beat that immediacy, you know, or the Mail one's going insane. You know,
a standing ovation for your Sean Kavanagh.
Or the Mayo one's going and seeing after you've said something, you know, or the Tyrone ones. And yet, you know, I'm constantly in clubs in these counties, you know, you're invited. Because they know your real self. They know that that's a part of that is. And also, we're only talking about football. And if you're not speaking your mind, well, then it's pointless.
That's part one of our interview with Joe Brawley. Obviously, we did this yesterday. And in the meantime, we've asked the head of sport of RTE, Declan McBennett, to address some of the issues and to come on air and have a chat with us about it. We haven't heard from him yet. We do hope to hear from him and to have him on. As I said earlier, I'm sure Declan McBennett's going to have his own version of the story about a lot of these issues, and in particular about how the story was leaked to the press, whether it was somebody in RTE or somebody outside RTE. But let's get back into it. Here's Joe talking about his relationship with Peter Canavan, the hardiest footballers that he's come up against, and he also continues to explain why he decided to join Air Sport.
Do you get a buzz from the feedback to things that you were saying if you actually hear, oh, there was a pub in Killarney with the commentary turned up at halftime?
You know what, like, you know, I mean, you could sense. I mean, I knew at halftime when I started to go after David with Kieran, obviously. Kieran was a wee bit, but when he saw me going in then he was in, you see. It's a great counterpoint, it's a great debating point then. Well, is that right or is it wrong? Yeah. Should he have given the penalty or not? Should he have given him the first yellow card or not? You know, was it a setting off in truth? Or has he, you know, has he succumbed to pressure? It was a great debating point. Whether it was right or not, you know, we're not discussing world hunger or paedophilia, you know. We're talking about the game that we love, our recreation, as we would in the bar. Geez, I wonder, did they get to?
Yeah.
Ah, no, they didn't.
Well, I mean, certainly that was a conversation in the stands that we were having. Like, when it happened. Then that's your view of what
it was so dramatic too. You know, the penalty was so dramatic, and from left field, and I spoke to David about it afterwards. You know, when the dust had settled and we were having a pint and that, and he said, "Look, you know, for me, if you watch the video again, he has put hands on Clifford before the ball has come, and he has moved him from where the ball was coming to about a meter away, and that's why I gave it." You know what, it is actually right that he did do that. And I wrote that subsequently, you know. And but again, I come back to the point, like, these are, in the end, Gaelic football. And reporting on it's our love and our recreation. And
the community aspect of it was, I think, at the heart of what was going on with your opposition to the Sky deal, right?
Yeah.
And so that...
Well, it was part of a philosophy that I have about the GAA. But... You know, that argument has been rejected. It's been rejected at Congress. There have been pitiful attempts to change it, which have now gone. That's all in the background. We're 10 years down the line. You know, and increasingly, you sound like a Luddite in your own ear. You know, my children, for example, what are you talking about? You know, they're mainly watching YouTube. I mean, I don't know if you saw the BBC Trust's report released last September, where the average age of a BBC... one TV viewer is 61, you know, or the Broadcasting Authority report here 2019 where the audience between 15 and 25, the TV audience has collapsed by 25% in 2 years.
They're watching on phones and they're...
You know, YouTube, streaming. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was down in Hope House, the rehabilitation facility in Foxford and Mayo, famous, and it was founded in September 1993 by two Sisters of Mercy. It was a great month. No?
Won the All-Ireland.
I like this guy.
He was just born.
Yeah. What's that? Yeah. That would explain.
No, not born? 94?
No, I wasn't born. No.
Right, okay. A star in the sky, we say.
But they founded Hope House themselves from scratch. What a humanitarian endeavour. And they're elderly nuns now, and there they were. We were meeting, and of course, in great good health, you know, as nuns tend to be. There should be some sort of medical teams and psychologists should be going down to see what the secret of their longevity is. But in any event, there they were, and the first thing they said to me was, "We're delighted you're on here. We get it free with our mobile phone package." And I didn't know that. You know that they're like 600,000 subscribers.
Look, you're...
You get Air TV free.
I know, yeah.
I did not know that.
Well, I used to work for them, so I know all that.
Yeah. And anyway, they were, whilst halfway through the meeting, they had to interrupt it to listen on their mobile phones to Midwest's coverage of Kilmaine playing Nagail in the All-Ireland Junior semi-final, another glorious defeat to a Mayo team. But...
You changed your minds.
I did, yes.
And that's like, I think people are entitled to change their minds if you're...
I think the argument has been lost. And Jarlath Burns, a pal of mine, he's going to be the next GAA president, he said to me, like, leave that alone, it's done. It's never changing. It's never changing. And of course, you've got a completely new landscape for media. And you just have to accept sometimes, look, I've made the argument, I fought the fight, it's over, that's it. I'm a GAA man first and foremost.
I think the other big thing is that Now TV, you can plug into the side of your telly for a tenner and get any game you want.
Well, the GAA's got its own subscription channel as well in GAA Go. And again, I've been on an odyssey for hospice. I'm the ambassador for the Mayo Roscommon Hospice and heavily involved with the fundraising. So we built the Mayo Hospice, opened it. It was formally opened in September past. And now we started the Roscommon Hospice on Friday morning. Sean Mulrane sank the spade into gravelly ground. And through that odyssey, I've met GAA people all over the world. I mean, I ended up doing a coaching day in upstate New York in Setanta for like 140, 150 kids. It's just like an Irish commune there in upstate New York. And for them, GAA goes a lifeline, you know. And so the GAA have that subscription model. I mean, one of the arguments that I've been making is that the GAA should own and produce its own TV for all GAA.
I think that there's a good chance that's where it's going, actually. They're learning how that works, and
it's going to be a subscription. But the beauty of that will be that, you know, the GAA will control that and will make sure, obviously, that the output gets everywhere. I don't know how you achieve that, but I think that people are so used now.
Well, we're spending $5 billion-ish on getting broadband everywhere. Once that happens, literally everybody will be able to stick it on YouTube, and it can be a private YouTube channel. And you can pay a subscription to the GAA, and they can take most of the money for it. And it sounds like pie in the sky, but
it's the reality, and we see it all the time.
Would you work for Sky if would that be a potential end of line?
Well, you know, there'd have to be a lot of inducements.
I mean, I was thinking about this. Someone
asked me this morning, and a big thing for me is, you know, because I knock about the hospitals far more than I should through the organ donation stuff, the transplant stuff and all that. And a big thing for me is the fact that in the hospitals, you know, our most vulnerable people don't see the games, the big games on Championship Day. And I'm sure it would be a cost of pittance. You'd know better than me, but it would cost a pittance to put Sky into the main hospitals and make it available on match day. Because 2 years ago, Dave Hickey and myself were doing a sort of a tour, which we do at Beaumont, you know. We're doing that when Dave was still there. You go up and you see the coordinators, the transplant coordinators, see what's required, how things are going. You know, you spend a day there. And Dublin were going to be playing, I can't remember who it was. It was a Saturday that we were there. And there were a load of Dubs with their Dublin jerseys on. You know, long-term, very, very ill patients, like transplant patients. And
Monaghan.
Getting ready to listen to it on the radio.
It was the Monaghan game. You did that game on the radio that night.
Yeah.
Is that the one?
I can't remember. Right. But getting ready to listen to it on the radio. Where I was in Killybegs Community Hospital last year. We played an organ donation game up there. And it was so much fun. And beforehand, Barry McGowan brought me, the great Barry, the great unheralded maestro of Donegal football. He brought me up to the community hospital, which is a beautiful place up there. And again, they were all bemoaning the fact that the following day they weren't going to be able to see the Donegal match.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that if this guy were saying to me, look, we will work with you and we will provide the games free in Irish hospitals, I think first of all it would be great for goodwill, and secondly it would be the sort of thing that would encourage me to... Like, this is all theoretical.
Sure, yeah.
So not about publicity move for Sky.
Oh, it'd be brilliant, you know.
What would the relationship, what would the chemistry between Joe Brolly and Peter Canavan on screen be like? Two Ulstermen vying for the microphone.
See, you've got to understand this. I, at heart, am a fan. You know, so for me, I mean, Peter Canavan was a god of Gaelic football. One of my treasured photographs in the house is that Peter came and played a game on an All-Star 15 that I was allowed to select whenever St Bridget's opened their new pitches. And there's a great photograph of him coming up to me when we're about to get a penalty to discuss the penalty strategy. And I treasure that photograph. You know, Peter is, and also a tough, a hard, hardy wee bastard. Like, I mean, he was a pure winner.
Yeah.
And, you know, so...
He still is.
You know, look, I've had many's the frosty exchange with Peter. But in the end, you know, he's a grown man and he'll pick up the phone and say to me, look, can you do X, Y, or Z for me? Can you do this? You know, and the answer is always yes.
I love that phrase, hardy wee bastard. Who is the hardiest wee bastard from Ulster, in your opinion? Or like nationwide, I presume you'd pick someone from one of your neighbouring counties.
I thought probably the strongest man that I ever saw on a Gaelic football field was Brian McGilligan, you know, who he hit Jack Sheedy one day, you know, but maybe a wee bit late. Jack underestimated McGilligan's speed in the Croke Park ground. And Sheedy was carried off, you know. I can't remember who. I think it might have been Tommy Sugru who said, oh, you were very late there, Brian. And Brian said, earnestly, I got there as quickly as I could. And he was the strongest man I ever saw on the field. I mean, it just like a stone wall, you know. But the hardiest was Kieran McKeever. You know, right. Peter Canavan said it was my misfortune to be born in the same era as Kieran McKeever. I mean, he was, and a club mate of my own. I mean, I remember scoring a goal off in the Dungiven training one night, and on the Thursday night he came back and he says, oh, flip sake, because he didn't curse. He got married very young, so he never cursed. He said, flip sake and flimmin' hell and flip me, Joe, and you know. But he came back and he says, oh, I know what you did. He says, I didn't sleep well last night. He says, but you'll not do that in me again. This was training for Dungiven club. But no McKeever sort of discussion would be complete without his exploits against Donegal. You see, Brian McAniff and Eamon Coleman loathed each other.
Right.
You know, they're from very different social strata, you know. I mean, Coleman was a brickie and Brian was a sort of a lofty hotelier, you know. And there was a very bad ill feeling between Donegal and Derry, and particularly when Donegal beat us in the 92 Ulster final, because everybody expected us to wipe them out that day after we'd demolished Down in the semi-final. And they caught us that day and deserved to win. And then we played in the National League. I can't remember, it was a quarter final. And Manus Boyle was on McKeever, you see, and Manus was doing a bit of, you know, well. And Fergal McCusker told me the story afterwards, you know, Manus was doing a bit of the element. And we were coming off at half time. McCusker said, that was hilarious. He says, McKeever was saying to him, flip sake, Manus, would you stop that? Obviously then emboldening Manus to think, look, you know, I mean, who says flip sake? And a flaming hell, now, Manus, like, seriously, don't be doing that. Now try and behave yourself, you see. And then, of course, the next thing, there's Manus lying completely unconscious on the ground with the blood scooting out of his... I can still remember it. The blood was... It was like a Quentin Tarantino scooting out of the gash above his eye where McKeever had hit him, you see. And the referee ran in and he said, oh, did anybody see what happened? And McKeever said, I think he fainted. And he then followed that up by knocking out Tommy Ryan. They then decided to have a friendly between Derry and Donegal up in Banagher. I mean, you couldn't make this up. And it was just absolute warfare. And Tommy Ryan was a very powerful fella. And no, he didn't play games off season then. And Tommy Ryan was at McKeever, you see, and bang, he was so powerful. And he was a great fist fighter, you know, and could handle himself 100%.
You were lucky that you were from the same club as him.
Yeah.
In a way.
Ah, well, if I was on McKeever, I wouldn't have been, you know. I mean, I wasn't dumb. Like,
you weren't doing any tricks around him.
You trash talked certain players, but not McKeever.
Come here. Are you now reflective about things? Was it a period of reflection?
Well, I've always been reflective about things. I mean, I don't like permanence, you know, and I hate turning down an opportunity. I mean, because you never know what you're going to miss.
Hmm.
You ever read The Great Gatsby? You know, the narrator in The Great Gatsby standing on the bridge as the car goes past, full of people that they're looking forward to the party, and he's dreaming of where they're going, and you know, itching to go there. I'd be like that, you know. So if I turned this down, I'd think, you know, this is Saturday night football too, which is
it's great. The stuff under lights, and in fairness, Satanta turned that into a thing, and that's now air like over 20-year period.
Yeah,
because these were league games that nobody else wanted at that stage, and then they came and they put production around it, and Dublin decided that the Croke Park thing on the Saturday night was going to be a thing. So it's actually proven that the league is the best competition the GA has. But I did.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Like in the first match there, I didn't realise this, but they told me today, and I've agreed to do 4 live programmes just to get the thing moving and to, you know, look, I love it. Like I'm like a fish in water when it comes to the telly. I love the telly.
Yeah.
Like Ron Burgundy, you know. But they had a most enjoyable discussion, and they said, look, if this is grown up, I mean, if there's any interference, I'm not interested. They said, no, absolute independence, you know, don't offend against the laws of libel, which I would never do anyway. I'm a barrister who's
talk about that off air.
Not never sued.
Did I not write a column for you one time back in our Satanta days where we ended up having a little, let's talk about that some other time, Joe.
Well, I thought you were going to say about the time that you got upset whenever I
didn't get upset.
Wrote about the interview of Mick O'Connell.
Adam Beck.
I knew you would hate it. I knew you would fucking hate it. And I thought I was writing it and the fucking tears were coming down my face. It was like Seamus Heaney being interviewed by Adam Beck. And I laughed out loud and my partner said to me, what have you written? I said, you're not saying it. You're not. It's gone. I knew you'd be so annoyed by that.
Well, there was no libel involved.
Thank you for your reaction today. I can see you still feel it after all these years.
That was the
Age are you? He says, what age are you? Do you remember?
That was the edited version that went out. There was a much longer version, which we should actually put out now at this stage. I thought it was
absolutely priceless.
Statute of limitations.
It was a collision of two eras.
It was. We couldn't communicate with him properly. We couldn't access him.
I don't think anybody could. He's not a YouTuber.
He's not a YouTuber.
No.
Can I ask you though, if you're always reflective, the rest of the way that the GA world is going at the moment, I feel like the culture war is ongoing at the moment, and the power of the senior round county teams, and we've spoken about this a good bit over the years, that is a runaway train, right? I do feel like the GPA have constantly been somebody that you've kind of fingered as part of the problem as opposed to...
But again, the GA allowed that problem to develop. I mean, it was the GA's inertia, the fact that they kept their head in the sand and hoped that it would go away, that led to the GPA. It's exactly the same with the Club Players Association. It's astonishing in the GAA when the primary duty is the club players, that the club players have felt the need to form an association. And we see again precisely the pattern that occurred with the GPA. Now, the difference, of course, is that the GPA are closer to the money, you know, so they were able to be disruptive and threaten and all those sorts of things. But the real problem, of course, is the length of the county season. So you condense that, you turn it into a 4-month festival of football, you get rid of the FBD League, the McKenna Cup. I mean, Terry Donnelly said not even the McKennas go to that anymore. The O'Byrne Cup. You get rid of all that nonsense. You have a 4-month county season that's a league running into a championship, which is then tiered. Players from Leitrim will be prepared to say, here, yeah, I'll play for 4 months.
Yeah.
You have a rule that your club's, the primacy of the club, unlike the soccer situation, the clubs release the players to the county, and that's how it works. Now you've got a summer, or you've certainly got holidays.
Yeah.
You've got a 2-3 month break at the winter time, and now you're restoring your work-life balance. You're able to have a relationship. You're able to develop your career.
The games are actually better as well.
games are better because...
And they're higher profile and we're waiting for them all year and we're talking about what's going to happen.
Absolutely. It's more exciting. You've got a festival of football. And the other thing is this. This long season, what has this done? Right? And I've seen this, right? So you'll see in Leinster, for example, where it used to be nip and tuck and everybody gets stuck in and have a go. It didn't matter who you were. Like, Louth could come out and beat the Dubs, you know. Well, you see that with the orthodoxy, the professional bandwagon that comes along with all of this, and the GAA shoehorning, you know, allowing a professional system to be shoehorned into an amateur sport, what you see is boredom, hopelessness. The coaching orthodoxy that has sprung up since Jimmy McGuinness's era, no fault of Jimmy's really, because there was a misinterpretation of what Jimmy was doing.
Yeah.
But that coaching orthodoxy, what we now have is what I call, for 95% of county teams, going through the motions football. They're not going out to win. The purpose of the game is to try to win. The underdog goes out and says, let's get fucked into them, boys. And that's what used to happen all the time. And every match had pitfalls. Every match, whenever we were the preeminent team in Ireland, four national leagues in all Ireland, we probably should have won more. Every match was a potential banana skin. Because you knew everybody was coming for you. You watch in Leinster now, everybody, they stand off Dublin, they drift back into their defence, they're playing formulaically.
It's pointless. The whole thing is pointless.
Because the point of the game is to win. Mm. That's it. Doesn't matter who you are, who you're playing against.
Even the games between evenly matched sides are pointless because ultimately they're going to run into Dublin at some point. So that whole competition, because it has a superpower. Like,
But the reason that a superpower exists is because of this 10-month season. That it's okay, Dublin can handle that. They can handle that. They have the resources to handle it. They're at the top of their game. They've got the players, etc., etc., etc. Nobody else can handle that. So what does teams... So Leitrim are out pounding the training pitch now, like four nights a week. Okay,
yeah.
They get slaughtered by Roscommon at the weekend in the FPD League.
And a bunch of players walk away.
No, what do those Leitrim players do in their mind? They know, okay, we're fucked. We're not going to win anything. You know, they go through the motions. They keep the county jersey. They go in there. But they play. They go through. Derry are exactly the same. We're a county, a really proud county, that now play go-through-the-motions football. You know, we don't go out and have a crack at Tyrone. It's embarrassing. We've got Rory Gallagher there now, you know, following a tradition of managers in the recent past who have just played don't-get-beaten football.
So it's a four-month season. How does it... Just explain to people how that might have an impact.
A four-month season, you're one. You're costing the county board a third of what you were costing them. So you reduce the expenditure by 70%.
We're spending 30 million a year roughly on international teams.
And county boards are on the verge of bankruptcy everywhere. And there's only a finite amount of money. And they've completely neglected their primary role, which is to look after the good health of the clubs and the GAA communities. So you condense, the first thing you do is you reduce that expenditure by two-thirds. Right? Second thing now is that you suddenly, you've got an amateur game again. Right? Suddenly you've got an amateur game again where the players are primarily club players. If you're a club footballer now, or if you're a county footballer now, you're not playing for your club at all. You do not play for them at all, maybe twice a year. Depends how many matches you have in the championship. And that's it. That's a charade as well, because it disheartens the club. It disheartens the club players, and it disheartens most definitely the supporters who don't see their best players any longer.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever me, McGilligan, Kieran McKeever, three All-Stars were playing for Dungiven, like, we played every match. And if you weren't there, you'd be saying, like, what's going on? What's going on here? You know, and we see this. Again, that's a problem that you solve by condensing. Once you've got the finances, the surplus finances, and you no longer need all this money, you know, now you've completely changed everything. Boys are prepared to sacrifice 4 months of their life.
Joe, in the likely case that things stay the same, because that often happens in the GAA.
Look at the CPA's. What recommendations were completely rejected. And you know what John Horan said last week? I mean, the president of the GAA, which illustrates the point, he said that the fixtures problem is unsolvable.
Look, it's the leadership is supposed to come from the electeds. It's supposed to be the president. Will Jarlath Burns, for example, be able to fix this?
No, because you need to be radical in order to protect the GAA community. You must be radical. You must have a social strategy. You must have a political strategy. We don't have a single lobbyist in the Dáil. The most important political grouping in Ireland, you know, from the most important community organisation in Ireland. We don't have a social strategy. So we're great at wakes and funerals. Jeez, we'll direct your cars and we will put our shoulder to the wheel for the grieving family. And we will spend nights without sleep. you know, and we'll make sandwiches and we'll be there for you through thick and thin. We need to translate that into something more permanent. You know, we need to have political influence as well. Because look at the power that we're wasting. I mean, in the north, the GAA put a lobbyist into, the Ulster Council put a lobbyist into Stormont, Ryan Feeney. We brought in over 140 million. Every club in the north has a state-of-the-art floodlight. That's just one small example. 65 million allocated to the Casement project. Obviously, we have sectarian issues in the north which are holding that back. But that's a small illustration. And yet all the hierarchy in Croke Park interested now is the All-Ireland semi-finals and finals. That's the year. How much commercial revenue can we gather around that? How much can we charge? You know, and that's it. So that's there. And you look at this Mayo problem. The GA, they say, we're happy to help. What help? What? Do what? Do what exactly? Nothing. You know, look at Galway. Look at Cork. I mean, Cork's completely out of control. Completely out of control with a 35 million debt. You know.
The solution
is not
to that,
good enough.
But what is the solution to have a finance person who works across a couple of different counties full-time, who's a full-time employee? Like, is that the type of stuff that we need to get to? Like,
the sort of radical thinking that you really need is to say, okay, look, we're going to forget about the... Let's start with what you would do if you were starting now. You would say, okay, look, let's forget about the British drawn county boundaries. Okay? Let's create 32 geographical units, if that's the number of units that we want to have. Okay? Divide them up by population. We pull the sponsorship, we pull the commercial revenue, we cut this down to a 4-month, 3-month festival of football even. The clubs stay the same. Right? The club is the primary unit of the game, but we have representational football, that'll be terrific. Nobody complains about it in Kerry whenever East Kerry come out and they play brilliant football, an amalgamation of 5 junior clubs who you wouldn't see otherwise.
Mm.
What's there to be afraid of?
I mean, change.
Did you watch, change. Did you watch Clifford playing for East Kerry in the championship this year on RTE? I mean, did you watch that?
Yeah, it was class.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Festival of football, you see the best players, you know, you watch them in a competitive environment.
Suddenly the
there's no point in the dumps. There's no point in Conor Callan and Paul Mannion and those boys coming out and battering poor old Wicklow, like,
yeah,
you know, and doing the interviews beforehand. Oh, you know, Wicklow, great team. Great, you know, their goalkeeper might be an under 14, but you know, he's the most promising under 14 in Wicklow, you know. We'll be paying them full respect, you know, and it's all a sham, you know, and of course, it's a, I suppose sport is this anyway, a triumph of hope over reality. But we've taken it to extremes in the GA. The system makes no sense. And what you need a small board of high-powered people. We have a load of high-powered people, you know, people who run major businesses, major financial organisations, major tech businesses, who'll come up and give, you know, do a brilliant part-time job. And that there should be a star chamber that organises the GAA, you know, and we need fundamental root and branch reform because we're not going to survive as we are. Basically, what we are, the strength of the GAA at the moment is this, that the parents will go down at underage level and from about 6 to 16, they'll do all the coaching and they'll have all that flurry of activity.
Yeah.
But it's becoming like mini rugby. Our participation rates, we drop 80%. When boys hit 17, 18. After minor level, they're gone. We don't see them again.
There's no games. There's no structure.
There's no games. There's no recreational football.
Yeah, there's no
five-a-side. There's no over 40s.
Yeah.
You know, we don't, unlike soccer, where you can choose and you play 20 games a year. I mean, we have just said it's all about elitism. Forget about that. And we say, look, and we're really, really lucky to have teams like Corrifin playing football and Dublin playing football. But what's beneath that?
It doesn't sound like you're in any way confident that there's going to be change. Is that your next?
Well, what inspires you to think that there's going to be radical change?
Because there hasn't been for a long time. You judge an organisation by its form, and the form of the GAA in the recent past has been a non-radical movement on certain things.
Yeah,
but why do you think
there will be change?
That's what I'm saying. I don't think there will be.
No, I mean, Tom Ryan said that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. John Horan says the fixtures problem is unsolvable. And without condensing the county season will have a dramatic and comprehensive effect on the health of the GAA.
And the individual players.
Well-being of the players.
Yeah.
It'll restore the life balance. it'll bring back the spark to the game. It's too long. It's too dull. And you see that with the players.
Well, you've got to be... If you're a Kerry footballer, you kind of need to be, Maria, at least fully fit for the start of the Munster Championship and then also at the end of the season. They've condensed the season a little bit, so maybe that's there are no longer the 9 and 12-week layoffs or the 9-week layoffs that they used to have. When
there's no break anymore. Players are just training through.
Yeah. Who can change this? Like because it's actually...
You need one strong leader in the team because we're leaderless. Well, I mean, Gilroy would have been perfect. He would have been perfect. Liam Sheedy would have been a very, very good leader. A lot of promise, prepared to delegate, to bring in expertise, to bring in people. And he made it down to the last two, but it was an awful shame because Liam's charismatic. He would have been, honestly striving to succeed. Honestly striving on a day-by-day basis. I'll tell you the sort of person Liam Sheedy is. He came to the opening of the Mayo Hospice in Castlebar because he wanted to see this triumph of communitarianism with his own eyes. He travelled up from Tipperary to the opening of the Mayo Hospice. Standing up the back chatting with him, And still very hurt about not getting it, because he would have been a terrific director general.
I'm sure Tom Ryan's track record qualified him for the position is the thing. And
tell me what that track record was, remind me.
Being the head of finance of the organisation and the finances of the GAA are in rude health when you compare them to other sports organisations at central level.
Administratively we're good, but we've come to the limits of that now.
Well, so I think that might be it. Tom Ryan might be a brilliant finance director and probably could have stayed in that role forever and that would have been fine.
But as a finance director, great.
It's set up, the organisation is actually set up to have a Politburo and what's supposed to be the visionary aspect of it, which is where the elected representatives come from. But Congress is set up to vote for lads who've been to Congress for 25 years.
The clubs send all their worst people to the county board now. The clubs really are completely disenchanted with what's happening at county level. Let's take Mayo as an example. So in Mayo, for example, you may get the superficial impression that they're a united county because they have such an avid sort of super fan following. Right, which is great, and football is a religion in Mayo, and it's a brilliant county. I love the county, I mean that sincerely. The people are magnificent. I spend as much time there as I can. But beneath that, there are clubs falling apart. There's huge distrust between the board and the clubs. Really, there's open warfare. And we see that in what's been happening over the last 9 months. Now, what will be done to address that? And the answer is nothing can be done.
No.
Because whilst this... as you describe it, this out-of-control train of senior county football does what it does. They're just being dragged along behind it.
You're not very hopeful at the moment.
Yeah, but I've set out a series of blueprints over the last 15 years.
And does it gain traction? Is that gaining traction?
Well, it gains traction with the GA people. But you just become a figure to be feared then with the hierarchy.
It seemed like you had a relationship with Pádraig Duffy.
Well, it didn't. Pádraig came to meet me on a number of occasions and asked me for support in relation to various things. And, I couldn't support him. He said, can you stop writing this stuff? Now, it has an effect, And they meet and they discuss these things. But, the problem is that they, like any very stagnant insular organisation, the greatest terror they have is change. What's he going to do, this outsider who's very bright, who's very strategic? What's he going to do if we bring him in here? Now, we know what he's going to do because he's one of our dudes. He's been here for 20 years.
Yeah.
And he's safe, and he can be controlled, but a new leader who might take us in all sorts of unknown directions.
What's next for you after this? Obviously, you have a lot of energy and you want to keep going. You're not going to get back on TV with RTE, so what?
I'm going to cut the ribbon on Saturday at the Tyconnell Pitch's new opening. I'm a very privileged person. I get invited to these types of things all the time. And then people come up, people have always felt the need to confess to me or to reveal their inner secrets, which is a great privilege as well. People come up to me and say, I must tell you a great story for your column. And often it does. It makes a great centerpiece. You're writing 50 columns a year.
You need
good
some help. Yeah,
just keep you moving. Get you moving and inspire you a bit. So I'll be there on Saturday morning with young boys. He's the under 20 captain, and they're playing Louth to qualify for the knockout stages if they beat Louth on Saturday morning. It's all my life's GAA. All the, you know, like I'll be at the club final on Sunday, obviously. Be great fun. And, you know, I have a very varied life. I mean, I'm starting a trial tomorrow in Newry.
So you're still working?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, you need some way to fund your altruism. Yeah. You need to fund it, like you can't. And
the altruism
and also
wasn't
it's a
always
great
part of your life. It was when you gave the kidney away that you realised that something has to change, right?
It was always a community person, but, you know, that was a very radical change after that, because you saw the suffering of other people properly. You actually felt it for the first time. And then that journey into transplant and cystic fibrosis and all, I mean, that was shocking for me to see, you know, our neighbours, you know, under our noses, suffering so terribly, you know. And so, you know, it was an easy, like, it was no great, I could ever understand when people compliment you for altruism, because there's nothing as selfish as the pleasure you get from altruism. You know, everybody should be doing it.
That's why it's powerful. You've been very good with your time. Your first game is the Dublin Kerry match?
No.
No?
No, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they sold
Dublin Kerry, okay.
Game to RTE.
Right.
Aired it.
Yeah, so your first game?
So there's a simulcast. But the first game we're doing then, which is the same, is Mayo against Donegal and Ballybuffet.
You're in Ballybuffet.
Which will be tremendous fun, you see, because, you know, the Donegal ones are a good crack and the Mayo ones.
They love
that. That'll be fun. And it's pitch side, you see. So that'll be rousing, I would imagine.
You need an umbrella to.
I'm genuinely looking forward to it, because I don't like closing down the options. I mean, if I like to open them up and, you know, try things and push myself and go for the unexpected. Like, the TV's easy for me because I love the telly.
Well, best of luck with it, Joe. Thanks very much for joining us today.
It's my great pleasure. OTB
AM. Right, always interesting to get the thoughts of Joe Brawley on where we are at the moment with regards to the GAA World. Plenty of reaction and analysis coming in from you guys out there. Listen to that, you can use the hashtag OTBM. And a reminder, of course, that Joe was in the studio, obviously, as Air Sport announced the details of their 2020 Allianz Leagues coverage. Over 7 weekends, Air Sport will broadcast a total of 15 football and hurling games. The coverage kicks off on Saturday, the 25th of January, with the home of Saturday Night Live GAA action broadcasting 3 matches across its channels. Owen, moving on to the new Aaron Hernandez documentary that was released last night.
Yeah, Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez. It's out now, dropped on Netflix yesterday afternoon. It's a 3-part true crime series about Aaron Hernandez, who of course was done for murder of Owen Lloyd, which happened around 2013, I think. At least that's when the police started investigating him. He was investigated for another double murder on top of that, but he was acquitted for that. And then eventually he died by suicide in 2017. So it's been something that's kind of been out in the public sphere for quite some time. The Boston Globe did a brilliant, was a 6-to-8-part series on Hernandez called Gladiator a few years back, which was outstanding, and particularly on the subject of CTE and the brain injuries that he suffered in the NFL. I thought that was the strongest point of that. I still think Gladiator and Boston Globe's work is the number one text on all of this, but this is pretty good. If you don't know much about the Aaron Hernandez story, you'll probably enjoy it a hell of a lot more than I did, because Netflix do true crime brilliantly and this is a true crime series. But I think this morning, like, just assuming that people have a relative grasp on the Hernandez story, I think the themes to kind of focus on from this and the things that we kind of learn from are some of the things that Aaron Hernandez has gone through as a kid, as a teenager, as a professional athlete, that resulted in the actions that he took. Like, we don't know the motive behind the reason why Aaron Hernandez kills Owen Lloyd, for example. We probably will never know the motive behind it.
Owen Lloyd was going out with Aaron Hernandez's sister, is that it?
Aaron Hernandez's fiance was the sister of Owen Lloyd.
Right.
Aaron Hernandez's soon-to-be sister-in-law was going out with Owen Lloyd.
Right,
so
okay.
they were seeing so sisters.
Right.
Which is a fascinating subplot to the whole thing, that Hernandez's fiance stuck by him during this entire thing, when her own sister was absolutely heartbroken in the courtroom hearing this evidence about the murder of her boyfriend. So that is, it's very tricky subplot that would have been negotiated by her in particular. We hear conversations between her and Hernandez throughout the documentary from prison. She stuck by him throughout the entire thing. But for me, like, there are a couple of things about this. Like, first of all, when you sit down to watch a documentary at the moment about a sports person, but particularly with an American sports person who's been accused of murder, you automatically make the OJ connection. Like, you go back to OJ Made in America from 2016, the best sports documentary of the century so far, possibly the best ever, absolutely outstanding. And like, that was as much of a deep dive into race relations in America at the time and the society in which OJ grew up in, as much as it is to do with OJ itself. And I think after thinking about this documentary for a little time, it's not too dissimilar to that, about what it tells us about the society that Hernandez grew up in. And like, Hernandez's sexuality is something that was touched on in the Boston Globe series, but I didn't quite realise just how important it was into perhaps his own mind until watching this documentary and the environment that he grew up in. I think the best thing before we kind of like start chatting about this is actually to listen to some of this. So Dennis Sansuki was the quarterback on the high school team that Hernandez played on. So Hernandez was the tight end, Sansuki was the quarterback, and they had a relationship in high school. And here is Dennis speaking in the documentary about that.
If I look at it now in the year we're in, yes, we were in a relationship back then, but at the time, you don't look at it like that. In school, there wasn't a lot of kids that were out of the closet. And the few that were, I used to feel like, golly, like, what a homo. Like, here I am, the football player. I was in such denial because I was an athlete. You mean to tell me that the quarterback and the tight end is gay? He sleeps with other men? No, it doesn't sit right with people. It doesn't sit right within our own stomach at that time.
So that's kind of the macho nature of football that's touched on. And one of the really great ideas of this documentary is that they chat to Ryan O'Callaghan, who was a former player with the Patriots as well, who's gay and didn't come out during his time playing football, but constantly says during the documentary that football was almost his guise. It was, he calls it his beard, like the way that he managed to feel more masculine, in inverted commas, about himself, or to put forward that more, project that image towards the public at least, which informs us probably of how Hernandez would have felt as well when he was hiding this from everybody. There's phone call records of him kind of making homophobic comments on the phone to his mom in prison in this documentary as well, clearly in huge fear of what would happen had he come out, because let's not forget as well, his father was an abusive father. He would have seen terrible things. He like beat up his mother. He was abusive towards his children. And he was a man's man, is how he put it. If his son had come out, Aaron Hernandez would not have been in a good place. So that culture of fear with regards to his own sexuality is something that existed from a very young age. Now, as I say, we'll never know why Aaron Hernandez kind of became the person that he became, why he became a killer or anything like this. But you start to unpick these different threads of the complicated aspects in his life. So that's just one thing. Like, for me, that's something that really sticks out from this. The big thing that has kind of come from the whole Hernandez story, though, is his brain. And it was obviously given up for research after his death. And they obviously found terrible levels of CTE within his brain, and not the first NFL player to do so. It's quite telling this week as well, when Luke Kuechly retires from football after multiple concussions during his career. It's kind of timely that this conversation is coming up this week as well. We might actually just have kind of a listen to another clip here, because I guess throughout the documentary we hear about the fact that the painkiller use during his college days was quite high. You'd have to play through a lot of pain. He was knocked out cold in a high school game. And then eventually he gets to the NFL, where he's playing for the New England Patriots, where Bill Belichick is the biggest, most dedicated winner of all. He wants to win. He doesn't care about fun. He will put you through anything. So what we're going to hear here is Aaron Hernandez chatting to his fiance from prison. But what you're also going to hear in the middle of this clip is a bit of commentary from the middle of a season. And you'll hear his former teammate, Rob Gronkowski, talking to a reporter about Hernandez's.
My body's broke, like, in the morning. People are like, what the fuck is wrong with you? I'm like a grandpa. Like, all my bones are, like, sore, you know what I mean? My body's so fucked up, honestly. Just from football, you know what I mean?
The time you got hurt on the field, and I had no clue what to do. I didn't know whether or not to run down and see what happened or to just sit there. It was really scary.
your compatriot over there, Hernandez, came out with a little bit of a head injury. How's he feeling?
Yes, he's feeling great. Hernandez is a beast. Love playing with him and everything.
All those drugs they shoot you guys up with and tell you to go out there and play.
Exactly,
play through your pain.
Exactly.
Go. Go.
So what's crazy? They banned that shit from the league, saying you only could take it if you have a serious injury or something.
Hernandez was the intended receiver, and he's slow getting up.
Guess who they gave that shit to every fucking game? Me.
Who is he talking to on the phone there?
He's talking to his fiance on the phone there from prison.
Explaining about the amount of times that when he was playing professionally, he was given a substance that was supposed to be controlled but wasn't.
Exactly.
In his instance.
Thanks for the pain. Like Chris Borland is one of the voices that speaks quite a bit on the documentary as well. A former San Francisco 49ers player. He retired because of his fears about his own health.
After one season. Great season. Like a really good rookie season. Started slow, came on strong at the end of it, and looked like he was going to be somebody who was going to be very good in the league for a long period of time.
Mm.
And gave it all up. Like walked away from millions and millions and millions of dollars after one season because of concussions that were happening in training that weren't being reported.
Well, that's the thing. That's something that actually isn't mentioned at all. Like, what was he doing to his head in training as well? Like, he mentioned the drug Toradol, which is a brand name of a fairly heavy-duty painkiller, which would have been given to college athletes. So, obviously, he had a hugely successful college career, Hernandez did, in Gainesville with the University of Florida. It's just as important to people down there as the NFL would be to people in New England. So, he played through a huge period, and undoubtedly, the fact that he played through that pain would have had severely bad damage on his brain. But like, these are just reasons that would have contributed to the decline of Aaron Hernandez. He might have been a murderer even without these reasons, without having a completely messed up childhood, even without having, like, his brother mentions again in the documentary that he suspects that Hernandez was sexually molested as a young boy, which is something that he came up in his book, but it's mentioned again in the documentary. Obviously, I mentioned his father and kind of witnessing domestic abuse. Like, his mother got into a relationship that really kind of damaged Hernandez emotionally as well. So you've got that, you've got the brain injuries, and like, who knows, maybe the whole gangster image he tried to put out there kind of comes from his own insecurities, which obviously resulted in him committing murder. So there's no definite answer to why Aaron Hernandez did what he did, but I think Netflix has done a pretty good job in illuminating a little bit of the potential reasons.
Yeah, it's just to put some context on this, he signed a $40 million deal after his third season with the Patriots, was a dominant tight end, not quite as good as Rob Gronkowski, but together they formed one of the greatest tight end partnerships on the field. I'm just looking up his stats there. In his 2011 season, he had 910 receiving yards in 14 games. So obviously he missed a couple of games through injury, and seven touchdowns. So a touchdown machine, a brilliant, gifted athlete, and part of the best team in America, where you would think whatever was going on in terms of the gangs that he was involved with, the crowd that he was running with, that they would have the architecture in place to be able to manage some of that.
Yeah,
but they didn't.
No, did it like that? This is a really interesting thing as well. That his own relationship with the Patriots, like he's talking from the prison to his fiance, and he's like, they were the best days of my life. He reflects on the Patriots days as a really happy moment. He goes to Gillette Stadium when he's in a bit of trouble, when he knows that the police are onto him to look for help. Robert Kraft testifies in his murder case. You know, like the image you see of Hernandez looking over his shoulder is kind of the one that everybody uses of him. Like, that came when Robert Kraft was standing outside the courtroom ready to walk in. A reporter says he looked over his shoulder seven times just to wait to see Kraft coming in, and he kind of had very big worried eyes on him at that point, as if this was the most significant moment of the entire trial. So his relationship with football is one that, in his perspective, would have been hugely positive, but at the same time he kind of realised that it was messing up his body as well.
Yeah, look, the point you're making is that personal responsibility in the end trumps everything. However, this is a disease-riddled brain, and the environmental circumstances were not particularly good. So he's battling against this. And at the same time, is it 100% certain that he pulled the trigger that kills Odin Lloyd?
It's not 100% certain. Like, it's 100%. It was impossible for anybody to argue against the fact of him being at the scene of the crime. Now, that is how he managed to get off on the double murder, is him not having pulled the trigger with a fantastic defense lawyer in his corner to be able to push forward that case. So, no is the answer. Nobody knows for sure, but perhaps, like, if you looked at it at a true crime perspective, people will probably be watching this if they come to it for the first time, thinking to himself, he could have covered his tracks a hell of a lot better as well. So it's not exactly the perfect crime by any stretch of the imagination, because it ended up putting him behind bars.
So there's 3 one-hour episodes worth digging into?
I think so, yeah. Like, even having listened to The Gladiator, I think it's worth watching. Like, if you haven't listened to The Gladiator yet, I'd almost start with this, because I think there's something more thrilling about a television documentary to actually introduce you to the subject.
Yeah, and then you can dig out the podcast afterwards. It was a Boston Globe podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, Killer Inside the Mind of Aaron Hernandez. 3 one-hour episodes available now on Netflix, dropped yesterday. You can read more of Owen's thoughts as well over on offtheball.com. Still lots more to come. The latest sports news and Deal or No Deal. We're back with episode 2 of Virtual Insanity, John Duggan's weekly golf tips, straight after these. OTB
AM. I'm praying for winners here, because I know the winners are going to come on our new slot on Off the Ball, Virtual Insanity. What is Virtual Insanity? It is golf tipping with virtual money. I know it sounds mad, but it's true and it's going to work, okay? So this is PJ Tour golf tips across the pond, John Duggan, every Thursday on Off the Ball, because I really have a feeling that we're going to get some great winners this year. Last week, a little bit unlucky in the Sony Open in Hawaii. Sung Jae-im and Rory Sabatini were in contention. Didn't work out. Close but no cigar. Hard luck stories. That's the way it goes. But I have renewed hope about this week's tournament. The American Express, don't leave home without it, in California. I'd love to be in the Hotel California right now. Unfortunately, we're in wet Dublin with an election campaign. That's the way it goes. But I'm really confident the odds are in our favour this week for these tournaments that are played in desert courses, 20 under par, birdie fest, 3 courses, La Quinta, and then the Nicholas course and the Stadium course out in PGA West. So I've given you 3 golfers this week. Let's hope we have a little bit of luck. Starting off with Jason Kokrak. Never won on the PGA Tour, Jason. American, 35-1 for a fifth of the odds for the places. The first 8 places, Paddy Power and Betfair. You can get that price in Jason Kokrak. What's the deal with this guy? Big hitter. Loves the course. Of course is. Tied 18th last year, tied 8th the year before. 14 top 25s last year, 5 top 10s. Played well in China at the back end. Jason Kokrak is a winner in waiting. I hope it's this week for Jason Kokrak for 5 each way. Who else? Sung Jae-im. I really believe in life giving people second chances. We gave Sung Jae-im a chance last week. He was close. He is another winner in waiting. 22 years of age, lighting up the tour. Brilliant in the President's Cup, Sung Jae-im. 3 euro each way at 16-1. He was also tied 12th last year in this tournament, and he's great at the par 4 performance. And finally, a rank outsider to give you your California holiday, Doc Redman. 250-1 for 2 each way. A fifth of the odds, 7 places. You can get that with Skybet, Doc Redman. The reason, don't worry about odds. Odds are just reflective of what the bookmakers think is somebody's chance. I think Doc Redman is a player who's really going to shine on the PGA Tour. US amateur champion, has the credentials as a collegiate golfer, and second last year in one of his very first starts at the Rocket Mortgage Classic when you needed to shoot low. So Doc Redman for the California holiday, 2 euro each way at 250-1. To summarize, overall pot, 970, that will go up. We're praying. We know it's going to happen. Week 2 tips. Put them on tomorrow by about midday, early afternoon. Tomorrow on Thursday. Put them on Thursday, midday, early afternoon. Jason Kokrak, 5 each way, 35-1. Sung Jae-im, 3 each way, 16-1. And Doc Redman, 2 each way, 250-1. This is Virtual Insanity, and we're back next Thursday.
Yeah, so obviously John records that on a Wednesday, so you need to get your bets on by mid-morning today if you want a bit of John's Virtual Insanity action. Now, Tom Malone is here with us. Tom, how are you?
Yeah, good, good.
What's going on?
Well, just a little bit of breaking news there, just on Jason Quigley and his next bout. It's been confirmed that Chris McNulty there in the Donegal Sports Hub has confirmed that Jay Quigley will face Mexican Oscar Cortez next Thursday. So it's a 10-round headliner on a Thursday night fight hosted by Golden Boy Boxing there. So we'll have more on that on offtheball.com very, very shortly. So a big night for Jason Quigley upcoming.
Yeah, they want to get him in action often and early this year and just boost the profile and get him, meander him into the contention for a title shot.
Yeah, a talented fighter. I mean, no reason why he wouldn't. He'd sort of come into that conversation in the next couple of months. Anyway, let's move on to rugby. And the biggest honour of my career, that's it, Jonathan Sexton described, being named as Ireland captain for the upcoming Six Nations. The Grand Slam, European Champions Cup and Pro 14 winning former World Player of the Year was nominated as skipper by new coach Andy Farrell yesterday. There were 16 Leinster players amongst the 38-man squad, including the uncapped trio of Caelan Doris, Max Deegan and Ronan Kelleher. But Sexton says he is excited for the tournament.
You know, it's something that I enjoy, but you know, it's ultimately it's a huge honour. It's the biggest honour of my career to be asked to do it, and I'm really looking forward to it and excited about the challenges that are coming up, and hopefully we can have a successful Six Nations now.
Meanwhile, in golf, Shane Lowry shot a 2-under par opening round of 70 in his defence at the Abu Dhabi Championship in the United Arab Emirates this morning. Double bogey on the par 3 in the back 9 undid a lot of good work there. Renato Paratore currently leads on 8-under par. Paul Carrington shot a 4-over par opening round of 76. Well, of course, the American Express gets underway on the PGA Tour later, so make sure you check out John Duggan's virtual insanity for that one. In football, Manchester United progressed to the fourth round of the FA Cup last night with a 1-0 win over Wolves at Old Trafford. The visitors had an opener in the first half ruled out for handball by VAR, something that didn't impress the manager there. But Juan Mata scored a second half goal, meaning they'll face either Watford or Tranmere next. By the way, that game has been rescheduled for next Thursday. United striker Marcus Rashford, though, was injured after coming on as a second half sub and is now battling to be fit for Sunday's Premier League match at Liverpool. His manager, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, says they took a risk that did not work out.
I didn't want to play him, but seems like it's a different. I think he got a knock to his knee or something in his back, but he's been struggling for a little while. That's why we've kept him away today. But we needed the win. He was involved in the goal, so that was a positive. But it backfired. So I can just say that we'll do anything we can to get him fit for Sunday.
Meanwhile, in cricket, it was a famous night for the Irish cricketers in Granada last night. They beat the reigning world champions, the West Indies, in the first T20 international. Of course, they lost the one-day series there. Helped by 95 off just 47 balls from Paul Sterling, Ireland set the Windies a target of 209. And despite some last-minute nerves, they did take their win there by 4 runs. Josh Little helping himself to 3 wickets. The sides meet again on Saturday. Well, just in cricket today, the third test between England and South Africa is underway in Port Elizabeth a short time ago. England won the toss, chose to bat, and were 26 without loss. That series is currently tied at 1-1. Of course, Master Snooker continues today as well. Sean Murphy plays Joe Perry in the afternoon, and Ali Carter against John Higgins later tonight.
All right, 16 minutes past 9. Tom, thanks very much for that here on OTB AM. Phil Egan's going to be in studio next for Thursday's Deal or No Deal. First, though, as part of our partnership with the GAA for the AIB All-Ireland Club Championships, OTB Productions has shot a video piece with the All-Ireland Club hurling finalist Barca Lee. We have a short segment from the piece on the way for you now. The full piece is available across Off the Ball social channels and on offtheball.com. It's a work of art. It's really beautiful stuff. The hurling and football finals both take place this Sunday, the 19th of January. Tickets are available from gaa.tickets.ie and usual outlets, including local clubs and Super Value and Central stores. Have a look.
You know, when you put on that jersey, that maroon and white jersey, you know, it's as Timmy quite rightly said, you immediately, if you reflect, you think of all the guys who went before. I mean, all the fantastic contributions that originated from here representing Tipperary. I mean, if you think of, we've had 4 captains and there's over 40 Celtic crosses in this small parish. And it all started with that.
I signed for them after the Euros, and after my first day's training, I was driving home. I was actually thinking,
regretting it.
What have I done? Like, I walked into a circus.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Time for this. Time for today's edition of Deal or No Deal. Sorry, I had my earphones turned down there. I was like, what? I'm talking. There's no one home. The sound coming out, but there's no sound. Right. We have an actual signing. Jose has brought Portuguese young gun Gedson Fernandes to London on an initial 18-month loan deal with an option to make the transfer permanent. 18-month loan deal is very long. Anyway, they beat off, it says here, competition from West Ham for a signature. Super agent Jorge Mendes is reported to have thrashed that deal out with Jose Mourinho, who, funnily enough, is also a George Mendes client. Oh, it's great. What a coincidence. What a happy coincidence. More Spurs news. Last week, the Sun reported that Krzysztof Piątek was a done deal, but the Mail say today that AC Milan are also in the mix. so we'll have to monitor that one. Given that he's been frozen out now by Jose, Troy Parrott is 18 in a few weeks. Is it time for him to flip the script and tell Spurs to stuff it if Mourinho is going to treat him like a child?
He is only a child. He's only 17. And you're thinking of Marcus Rashford was 17 when he made his debut for Manchester United. He was taken off the bench as a late replacement. Starts against Mitchell and scores. Then obviously scores against Arsenal in his Premier League debut. He made his 200th appearance for United.
Wow.
Over the weekend.
He's a seasoned pro now.
He's only 22. But the worry there is, given the style of play that he has, is that he is going to pick up injuries. Got injured last night. He has issues with his back. So I know we're all excited. We see Adam Ida starting at Old Trafford the other day, but that's at Norwich. There's no way Troy Parrott is going to become a regular at Tottenham at 17 or 18. So I'm wondering, I think the next step is loan. Like, does he go out and loan next season and just see out this season?
But the Euros are in Dublin this summer and we need someone to score goals.
He'll get his
now.
He'll get his
now,
run.
Phil.
No, but he'll get his run towards the end of the season when Spurs have nothing to play for in the Premier League, when they've already missed out on top four. And
you're spoiling my follow-up question here. What percentage chance do Spurs have of finishing the top four with Jose at the wheel? I want a number.
For this season?
Yeah, right
zero.
Now.
Zero.
0% chance?
0%.
Woo!
No. 30%. 40%. 40%.
40%. So you think that's a pass, though?
It's a pass, yeah. I give him every chance in the managerial stakes against Frank Lampard and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Brendan Rodgers, for that matter. Well, maybe not Brendan Rodgers. I would say at the moment Rodgers is a better manager than Jose Mourinho. But once I believe that, I believe they can do anything. And if they manage to get Christian Eriksen out of the club, for example, things might seem a little bit more positive for them. The question I have is, what's Troy Parrott going to do for his 18th? Is a professional footballer allowed to have a big bash? Does he invite Jose Mourinho along?
You do not invite Jose Mourinho along. Or if you do, it's like no booze will be served at this 18th.
If you don't invite Jose, though, how's that going to go down with Jose?
Mm. Oh, you do invite him, but then there's no booze.
Yeah. It's just, like, do you know what? It could be
sandwiches,
it could be like
crisps,
a day,
potato, and
a foot golf or something for the birthday.
Yeah.
Fizzy red lemonade. Well,
you could pick up injuries doing that.
That's very true, actually. Yeah.
You look at Lukas Fabianski, picked up an injury kicking the ball the other day.
It's,
imagine Troy Parrott brings the Spurs lads out for a game of foot golf and Toby Alderweireld is trying to ping one onto the 18th and pops his hamstring.
If you say foot golf quick enough, it sounds like something completely different. It's occupational hazard, actually, kicking
football. I've never actually played.
No swearing in the show today, Owen. We're going to keep it that way. West Ham are planning a loan bid for Chelsea's England midfielder Ross Barkley, aged 26. He previously played under Moyes at Everton. Would this be good business?
I think it'd be good for everyone involved because it's clear that Barkley's not first choice under Lampard. He'll get chances because they're obviously...
He started last week.
Yeah, like he will start games, but he's not going to start every game. He improves West Ham's midfield because he's an upgrade on Mark Noble. And it gets regular football with the Euros coming up.
You'd watch a midfield with him, with Jack Wilshere, Declan Rice. That midfield trio.
No, it's Declan Rice and Ross Barkley.
Put Jack Wilshere in there as well.
Jack Wilshere, did you see what Jack Wilshere's up to these days?
He's jumping out of washing machines.
That's what he's at.
Big washing machines.
Big washing
Very
machines.
Very big, actually.
Probably a dryer, to be fair.
It's probably where the kit's done.
It must be. Calcio Mercato report that Inter have agreed personal terms with Danish midfielder Christian Eriksen, who's 27, over a permanent loan move this month. Sorry, over a permanent move this month. They want it for 10 million euros. Spurs are looking for 20 million euros. PSG are also in the mix there. Don't sign anything. Let them put a gun to your head. They're not pulling the trigger. Don't sign anything and take the 20 million for yourself as a signing on fee and still get the salary in 5 months' time. Don't sign anything.
Yeah, he wants to play football, though.
And then what if Inter Milan turn around and say, well, we're not going to take you in 5 months' time?
Okay, grand. I'll go somewhere else.
Somebody
PSG will pay me a ridiculous amount.
Somebody will take him on a free, definitely. He would suit the Italian league because it's a little bit slower, but he'd get more time on the ball. And obviously we know if you get him time on the ball, he's
going to look like he did against Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. Who knew that he would do that damage if we gave him the freedom of the Aviva Stadium?
Yeah, let's take off all our central midfielders. Spurs are cashing in at this point when they should have cashed in last year and they would have got six times this.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a problem with the model that Spurs have used over the last few years.
For a shrewd businessman.
Well, we keep hearing about how shrewd they are. We keep hearing about it. What a brilliantly run club, how amazing it is. how good is the team at the minute? How strong is the depth they have in the squad?
Yeah,
they're
not very good. So not very good.
What's the point of having a football club if you're not actually that good at running the football club?
I think, in fairness to Daniel Levy, it was all about the stadium for him. And now he's bringing in Jose Mourinho to think, right, there's the stadium. Now we need the manager to deliver trophies. And Jose might win that FA Cup this season.
I think the bookmakers have Spurs odds of top four at about 16% at the moment. So you're 40%, you're 30%.
Very confident.
Right. Edinson Cavani, well then that's a good bet. Edinson Cavani, 32, is out of contract in the summer. A number of English clubs are monitoring. Atletico Madrid are hoping to bag him in January for 20 million, but PSG want 30. Which English club would you like to see Cavani join? The correct answer is Aston Villa. Well done.
Tottenham.
So you're just ruining Troy Parrott even more?
Yeah. I don't want to see Irish people succeed. No, like we all know this. I'm joking, obviously. Troy Parrott is not going to make the breakthrough this season.
No.
Might not make the breakthrough next season. If you are a club that needs a centre forward, which Tottenham Hotspur do,
yeah,
then you go and you get yourself a bit of Edinson Cavani. He's old, but he's good. So you've got a young striker who's good, or you've got an old striker who's proven to be good. You go for the old striker, even though it's going to cost you tens of millions.
Can he win that direct ball that Jose Mourinho wants his players to play?
Well,
is the direct ball definitely gone through the middle? And like, is that not...
Jose just, when in doubt, lump it up to the big man.
Is Lucas Moura going to win that direct ball?
He's a better big man, though, I would argue, than for that style of play, than any of the other big men that we've seen him try it with, like Lukaku, for example, who just wasn't really into that kind of ball.
No, because he doesn't have the best touch at times.
Cavani might actually be, at this stage of his career, get that ball up to him early where there's a little bit of space.
Yeah.
It's not the worst shout, is it?
Okay, Cavani, let's just go classic 4-4-2, Cavani and Moura up front together, a new kind of buddy cop film.
Son on the left, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
He wasn't, he'd forgotten about Son, that was the truth.
No.
Son's coming off the bench.
No, Son on the left, 4-4-2.
Oh, you humiliated him there, Phil, well done. 9:25 this morning, Mundo Deportivo report that Liverpool are the front runners to sign 20-year-old Bayer Leverkusen midfielder Kai Havertz for some £107 million. What? Is that right? It's not 10.7, is it?
No.
What? It's not a typo. Man United, Barcelona, Bayern Munich are also in the race for a signature. Who is Kai Havertz? Club side are expected to bag him.
So this lad has been talked about for the last couple of seasons. He was in the Bundesliga team of the season last year, and very good player. You kind of think when young players, when they're linked to clubs, and Bayern Munich are one of those clubs, that he's going to Bayern Munich.
At this
That's
price.
Just the way things go. I don't really see Liverpool spending 107 million on this guy, but it's a nice story because it fits in with obviously Jurgen Klopp, who obviously had a huge, unbelievable reputation in Germany. But that's just gone through the roof now.
So we can pick whoever he wants now.
So
he can beat Bayern Munich to all the best young Germans.
He could do if he wants. And there's no doubt Liverpool have to buy players. They didn't buy any in the summer. They've obviously brought in Minamino. But if they go on to win the league like we all expect them to do, they do have to freshen things up.
Even the African Cup of Nations is going to take three of the lads away for 6 weeks next year.
Yeah, well, the Naby Keita one I thought, well, rarely plays anyway because he just seems to be injured all the time. But if you're losing two of the front three, that's an issue, especially Mane.
And the thing about it is, it's not just the 6 weeks of the tournament. They're always fairly exhausted afterwards and because they're the main players in their team.
And they play for teams that can go to the latter stages of the competition.
Because they're so good themselves as well,
And I remember when Mane, his first season at Liverpool, they drew 2 all the way to Sunderland and he went off then to the African Cup of Nations, and Liverpool's form fell off a cliff. And people put it down to the fact that it was Klopp not really being able to cope without a winter break. He was just new to the Premier League, but new enough to the Premier League, but they miss Mane so much.
So where would Havertz play?
Well, he's more one of the three in midfield.
Yeah.
So like one thing that has... It's so clear watching Liverpool's midfield is it's very functional. There's players, I know that there's been an argument this season, or was it Andy Gray said during the week that Jack Grealish is better than all of Liverpool's midfielders? And he may well be right in terms of individually, But collectively, Liverpool have a way of playing with the midfield. So
is this guy better than Jack Grealish?
He's probably
a bit risky, isn't it? At 107 million.
Yeah, like he is. He's good.
Right. Okay.
I don't know.
Is this going to happen?
No, I don't think so.
Leicester City have asked Man United about the availability of Luke Shaw, who is only 24.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. In case fellow English left back Ben Chilwell moves to Chelsea, that's a report from the Mail. What would Luke Shaw's Man United legacy be?
Being fat chained by Jose Mourinho.
Ice cream.
Broken leg.
Oh yeah.
Bad injury.
Not great, is it?
Bad injury.
Well, his legacy would be he's rich. That would be his own legacy. His own personal legacy would be I got rich at Man United.
Bad injury, being essentially bullied by Jose Mourinho and being their player of the season last season.
Was he actually their player of the season though?
No. Yeah. But they had such a bad season.
Manchester City have ruled out 25-year-old England centre-back John Stones joining Arsenal this month, according to the Manchester Evening News. Oh, and as an Arsenal fan, Arsenal are 10th, 11 points off 4th right now. What's a successful second half of the season?
Win the Europa League. Just go and win it. Go and win it, Mikel. Go and do it. Get it done. Bring it home.
They couldn't win it with the expert at winning the Europa League.
I know, they couldn't. But maybe Mikel Arteta is Unai Emery in wait. Just needs to get the locks longer and greasier, and then he will morph into a full version of...
What about the league position?
The hair.
What's a good league position for them?
Well, a good league position is top 4. An acceptable league position is top 6.
A great league position from this spot is top 4. That would be a great end of the season.
Yeah, that's another zero. That's actually minus of Arsenal finishing.
Percentage?
Yeah, in the top 4.
Minus 10%.
Do you think Spurs have a better chance than Arsenal?
Yeah.
Well, I would agree with you.
All right, 9:30 this morning. That is it. What a busy show for you. Thanks very much for joining us. We will be back on your radios tonight from 7 o'clock. You can subscribe to the OTB AM podcast, though. Fully timestamped, making it very easy to find exactly what you want from every morning's two-hour show. We're on Spotify and iTunes. Of course, we're on the GoLed app as well. It's the best place to get us. OTB Sports Radio is a permanent fixture there. This morning, top 5 stories, football with Daniel Harris, Deal or No Deal, the OTBAM review of the new Netflix doc, Killer Inside, the mind of Aaron Hernandez. You can check out John Duggan's Virtual Insanity Golf Tips over on our IGTV or on offtheball.com. And also the Joe Brawley interview, the full 45-minute chat will be available today. You can find us on podcast or also on YouTube, where you can get us to cast to your smart TV. OTBAM, Ireland's first and only sports breakfast show, with you every morning from 7:30. We'll see you tomorrow. Best of luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.